sometimes stick some school districts with
The two other leagues we probably should do.
Except
we're going to do Uyghur first.
Except it's...
Is that okay?
The school districts all don't know that they're on the hook for a fair chunk of cost. There's a process issue.
The Legislative Commission on Pensions and Retirement will come to order. We will start with number four, Senator Uyghur. Mr. Martin. Then we'll do Senator Michelle.
Members, there is the copy of the dash BA-011 amendment in your packets. There is not a memo on this. This relates to the Teachers Retirement Association. It relates to a single West St. Paul teacher who had a medical leave for which there was not proper reporting to TRA, and this permits a service credit purchase of the leave period by the teacher. The teacher would make the member contribution. If you look in the document BA-011, the member contribution is laid out at page 1, lines 16 through 18. The school district contribution, which is the balance of the full actuarial value, is laid out after line 1.18.
Second, then I heard that.
Okay, and this is a circumstance where the district failed to notify TRA of the, was it a disability leave?
It's a medical leave, Senator.
Medical leave.
And TRA is here and could respond about the actual factual setting.
Mr. Thompson.
Luther Thompson representing TRA. Yes, in this case, the school district failed to report the leave in a timely manner. The way the bill is written, the employee or the teacher would pay her contributions plus interest. The employer would pay the balance of the full actuarial value. So in this case, Dorothy Fent would pay roughly $2,646, and the school district would pay $33,957. The full actuarial value is $36,000.
Okay, any questions on this one? Okay, then TRA has two others like this that we may not be able to put on here today, but that we want to discuss because when the work has been done on them, perhaps they'll be added later. They're very similar to this. Mr. Thompson?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. There are, if we're going to do this, there are two others that members have appealed to the executive director at TRA and the board. One relates to a part-time teacher program where the teacher wasn't reported as being in that program, and another relates to an extended leave program that was not reported as well, and we have the dollar figures for that. I've discussed these with Mr. Martin, and I believe he does have amendments dealing with those as well. So all three of these, the employer failed to report in a timely manner. Therefore, the teacher is denied the service credit. And in all three of these, the payment mechanism is the same. Full actuarial cost with the member paying the employee contribution plus interest for that period of time.
Okay, and we're passing out two amendments, the BA-029 and the BA-030. And 29 is the Hopkins situation, and the 30 is the Forest Lake. It's my understanding that Hopkins, with regards to Senator Uyghur's bill, which is West St. Paul, the district is aware of this. They believe they are culpable because of the... They support the bill. We do not. How about Hopkins and Forest Lake? I think we're at a point where they are not. We have not yet had a chance to talk with them.
Right.
Okay, so I think it would be premature to deal with the Hopkins and Forest Lake situation until the fund has had a chance to visit with the district. But with regards to BA-011, West St. Paul agrees. Matter of fact, they're the one that encouraged the employee to come forward. And so I don't think there doesn't appear to be any controversy with regards to 011. And we just don't know about Hopkins and Forest Lake yet. The fund just hasn't had a chance to visit with them. So, Representative Smith, would it be okay? I think we should put the 011 on And then after TRA has talked with Hopkins and Forest Lake, we can make a judgment on those two?
Mr. Chairman, I think that's reasonable.
Makes sense?
Yes.
Okay, is there anybody in the audience who wants to testify on the 011, which is the West St. Paul situation? Okay, Senator Bedsold moves, or Senator Smith, Representative Smith moves the 011 be incorporated. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, motion adopted. Anybody want to testify on the 029 or the 030? Thank you, Mr. Thompson. Thank you, Senator Wieger.
Thank you.
Okay, then we will hold off on the 29, which is Hopkins, and the 30. This would be the language, assuming the districts believe that it was their reporting error.
Mr. Chair, could I speak to an amendment regarding Red Wing that maybe could be applied
sure.
to this
yes.
bill? And I believe Ed Minnesota's here. They can speak more fluently on it than I can, but it's related to Crosby-Arrington strike and does the same thing for Red Wing that we did for Crosby-Arrington.
Okay. Ed Minnesota, do we have have language?
The amendment is B8026.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, last year in the pension bill, there was a provision that was passed dealing with the teacher strikes, and they dealt with the Crosby-Arrington strike, and it was our understanding that they were taking care of International Falls and also Red Wing. We had a International Falls teacher approach us and say that while they took care of part of the problem, it wasn't completely fixed. And so we asked our teacher actually talked to pension staff to draft language to fix it so that they are all equal, treated equally.
If you do this, I wouldn't go back any farther than 2002.
Mr. Martin?
Members, the 026 amendment replicates the Crosby-Arrington matter that you dealt with last year. That was a strike that had concluded just shortly before the session, during the course of the session, and you did make a retroactive application of the generalized strike provision language that was included in the 2005 Omnibus Pension Bill. So future strikes are handled by the 2005 general language that was added. This would move that provision back and make it retroactive, as it were, for the International Falls strike and the Red Wing strike. They both occurred in the 2002-2003 school year. As we get pushing these provisions back farther and farther, I do have concerns about this not being full actuarial value. Potentially, the individuals in the International Falls or the Red Wing strike would have 1 year to make the contributions that they would have made. I would be very concerned if we went back before 2002. These are getting more and more like true service credit purchases and do obligate the pension fund to a greater cost than the monetary value of the contributions.
Mr. Thompson.
Mr. Chairman, Luther Thompson representing TRA. I think that these are the only two that are sort of within a reasonable period of time. My understanding of this, and I guess Mr. Martin can correct me, when I read this and I went back to look at this, the section 356.195, was that these teachers, it's beyond the 1 year after the strike was settled, so they would all be paying full actuarial value for the... In the Crosby-Arrington situation, they paid contributions and interest if it was paid within 1 year of the strike settlement and then full actuarial value after that year. So I'm assuming that these folks would be paying full actuarial value, and if that's incorrect, then we would have a problem with that because they would be treated differently than the people in Crosby-Arrington. People in Crosby-Arrington had 1 year after the strike settlement date to make the payment, and after that they paid full actuarial value. These people are way beyond the one-year strike settlement date.
Should we make it full actuarial value?
Why don't you just make a motion to that effect? I think I've got to
If that's what it takes to pass, Mr. Chair, we better do that.
Safest.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Maybe there could be a little bit of a compromise because this issue was supposed to be fully taken care of last year, and now this is going to be an additional actuarial burden on our members. If we could at least go back to 2005 when we had the understanding that this was fixed back then, I think that would be a fair compromise.
We understood that. We certainly didn't.
I don't think we quite understood what you were suggesting.
Well, as I understand it, Mr. Chair, you are proposing that it would be fair to do the actuarial value. Is that correct? And as this legislation was in the bill last year, we understood that it was fixed completely last year. And when a TRA member from International Falls informed us that there was a little glitch and that part of it wasn't fixed, that we needed further legislation to get back to where everyone thought it was in 2005 with the 2005 legislation. So I would just ask that they not pay the actuarial piece from last year for the last year.
But he wants it.
I think it needs to be full actuarial value.
The money has to be full. I'm trying to
see how I'm waiting for a motion. Representative Wardlow moves that BA-026 be incorporated with additional language that makes it full actuarial value. Perhaps you could continue to discuss it with the fund. I don't know how successful you're going to be, but.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I'll go back to and review this, but when I looked at it last week, that was my understanding of it, and I could be wrong, but I'll also talk to Mr. Martin to make sure that we have the right understanding.
Representative Murphy.
Mr. Chair, in relation to what Ms. Allswiger said, I don't understand why, if we addressed it in 2005, why International Falls and Red Wing weren't included.
Well, Mr. Chair.
Senator Betzel.
As I recall, well, first of all, we recognized, I think, as a result of the state, when the state employees went on strike, that if they wanted to make, because there were no contributions made during the time that they were on strike, and I think that's what brought the issue to our attention. And so we addressed it. Now, it just happened that the Crosby-Ironton strike had just happened, and by the time the legislation passed, I mean, the strike was over. So the employees who wanted to buy back into their period of time didn't have to go back very far simply because the strike had just happened. But I think that the reason why, you know, we were aware of that because we just had ignored that, the Crosby-Ironton situation. I think what's happening here is that there are employees from the International Falls and the Red Wing, which happened a few years ago, that now they want to be back. And now I think that's where the difference is because we're not just trying to make up the missed contributions from a few months ago. We're trying to go back a few years, and that's where the added costs come in. So I think that's why the difference seems to be there.
Mr. Chair, Senator Betzel, then International Falls and Red Wing weren't talked about with the Crosby-Ironton situation.
No.
They weren't written into the language.
Mr. Chair, no. Crosby-Ironton was brought to our attention, Mr. Chair, last year,
right,
simply because the strike had just happened, and I think we were trying to address the situation where the state employees went on strike, and we weren't looking back at previous strikes. But that just happened to be there, and we knew that by the time that the 2005 bill had passed, I think by the time we'd already put the bill together, the strike was over. So the only way you could help them was to make it retroactive, and I think that was something we did actually quite late in the bill to pick them up. You know, now knowing the situation and realizing that if we didn't do it now, you know, they could not buy back in. But they weren't having to pay much, simply they were just missing the previous few months' contributions that they had to pay.
And so if they hadn't heard, they would be paying full actuarial value.
Mr. Chair, I think that had any length of time passed, more length of time, I think they would have had to have paid full actuarial value. It just happened that it just, when we did the 2005 pension bill, as I recall, the strike, it just concluded.
They haven't brought the legislation.
Mr. Martin?
Ready to go?
Members, if you want to adapt the language for full actuarial value, I would suggest on line 1.5, deleting the words "the payment deadline specified in" and inserting "any provision of." Then on 1.6, deleting subdivision 2, paragraph B. And then on line 1.13, deleting in parentheses B and inserting in parentheses C, and deleting the balance of that line, and deleting the balance of line 1.14 up to the period. So this would provide for full actuarial value, which is paragraph C of section 356.195, subdivision 2.
Representative Wardlow moves that language. In addition, on 1.12, we need a space between and 25. I'm stunned that you didn't see that, Senator Bedsold.
1.12.
There's a space error there. Okay, on the Wardlow amendment.
Saves money.
All on the Wardlow amendment, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, motion adopted. Now on incorporating BA 026 as amended into the first omnibus bill discussion. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, motion adopted. Thank you. If there's new information on that, Ms. Alzweiger and TRA, let us know. Okay, Senator Michelle, number one. Mr. Martin.
Yes, members, this is a revisiting of a bill that you had looked at a prior commission meeting. The thrust here is a particular ex-spouse of a Minnesota Public Pension Plan member has not been able to receive the portion awarded to her in the marriage settlement because the former Minnesota Public Pension Plan member has not yet started drawing the pension benefit. And this is a problem for the constituent of Senator Michelle. I think Senator Michelle has an amendment which would shift this from a general statute change to a single provision just for the particular constituents.
While that's being passed out, is number three, are you ready with number three?
Sure.
We're going to do this first. Yeah. I just wanted to know. And the Bloomington situation, where are we on that, the number two?
Representative Larson is here, I know.
So we're ready to go on that one? Okay. So we'll take Bloomington next.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Michelle.
Mr. Chair, the A4 that's being passed out, thank you, Mr. Martin, for doing some heavy lifting and staff work on this. This would, after our discussion of a couple weeks ago, Mr. Chair and members, this would scope down this bill so that it only deals with the instance that was brought before the commission, Ms. Hansen. Ms. Hansen is here, by the way, if you'd like further testimony. But you recall at one point Representative Smith brought up the concern about really blowing this open into general Minnesota divorce law. And our sense was that the commission didn't want to set that kind of precedent, but that we did want to try to take care of Ms. Hansen and her situation. So the A4 does that, Mr. Chair.
Doesn't it affect, though, the way A4 is drafted, set the precedent? It's just for one person, but it sets the precedent. So let's look at the A3. I'm just trying to quickly move to the possibilities here. Do we have an A3?
Members, I do have another amendment, which is a somewhat different. The issue is the difference between the A3 amendment that's being passed out and the A4 amendment is the question of the trigger of when this special provision would go into effect. The one that you're looking at, the -A4, has no particular trigger. The simple passage of the provision would trigger its our relief for the constituent. The A3 document would require a court to get involved. I determined that the public pension plan member has no reasonable reason to not draw a benefit. And if that finding is made, then other relief would be triggered.
So the language to look at in terms of difference is on 1.5 to 1.11. So how would that work? A court would look at it and find...
Would make a finding, Senator, that there's no reason... the finding is actually laid out in 1.13 through 1.21. And the key part is 119 through 121, that the not drawing of the benefit doesn't have a rational reason.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Michelle.
If I may, I think what this boils down to is the difference between requiring Ms. Hansen to go back to court or not. The A3, as I understand it, would require her to go back. So we've got to hire attorneys again. And the A4 would not. The A4 would not. Given what she's been through, and again, given the discussion we had a couple weeks ago, I'm comfortable offering the A4 and hope the commission will consider that.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Smith.
Ms. Chairman, there was discussion at the last meeting on your bill, Senator, and suggestion, and I think even your acceptance that you would run this issue by the family law section of the State Bar Association. Have you done that?
I have not, Mr. Representative Smith.
Ms. Chairman, Senator, I hope you won't mind if I take this to them and get their counsel, get their advice as it works its way through the House.
And I
think it's important that the family law section, they've been known to provide lots of testimony on family law bills in the House. And I would like to know what their position is. Since you haven't done that, I guess I would like to seek that. For purposes of moving us along today, however, I would like to see that occur.
Do you have a preference on A3 or A4?
Mr. Chairman, I guess my preference would be A3.
And Mr. Chair?
Senator Betzold.
One of the things that, and I don't know the answer to this, and hopefully we would be able to determine this before there's the final passage of this overall omnibus bill, is the fact that in a divorce there are some issues that are kept open, for years after the divorce, usually child custody, child support, those kinds of issues. Property issues are usually closed out. Now, I think that certainly a motion could be made to the court saying, look, we had this judgment decree from the court. One of the parties has thwarted it, so equitable concerns would dictate that we should be allowed to, go back and revisit it, especially because of legislative action and so forth. But I don't know how a judge would look at it. A judge might say, no, I've decided this issue, and, we're done with it. I think a court should open it up, but I don't know that a court would do that. So I think that, I do appreciate the policy interests that maybe the Bar Association might have, but I also have some concerns about what a particular judge might do. He might not take the action that we would anticipate here. So, hopefully, if regardless of whether we go the A3 or the A4, Ms. Hansen, can consult with her lawyer, and they can do a little bit of checking into before we get this bill finally completed.
Mr. Chair, to Senator Betzold's point, I do have a copy, and I'll pass this out as well, of the actual. We referred to this last time as the quadro,
right.
The domestic relations order, and you will note it's pretty specific as to the pension. So we know what this particular judge said. And this was in February of 2000, so some 6 years ago.
But my point, Mr. Chair, Senator Michelle, is will the judge say, look, I've decided this issue. I'm not going to spend any more time on it. So I don't know what he ordered how it was to be divided. I don't know whether he feels he's been divested of further jurisdiction. So
doesn't the A3 give the court something to work with? Doesn't it almost force the judge to make a determination here?
It could. It might. That's how I would read it. But.
It's not a good idea to go without an attorney, just like a lawyer.
I mean, it seems like the
Michelle's a lawyer, too.
The concern I have about the A4, Senator Michelle, is that we don't know the whole fact situation. I mean, we just, there's no way we can tell. It's not to question the veracity of what we've heard here. It's just that, how do we know?
I mean, you and Steve and Beth Solger and Michelle.
My advice is go with the A3, and if something is found as this goes along the way, it sounds like there may be some more flexibility, but... Senator Michelle moves the A3.
I might be wrong.
Sure. Discussion? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Motion adopted. That's for incorporation in the first bill. Okay, number two. Mr. Martin.
So we did A3?
Yes. Members, this is a service credit purchase authorization. In this case, we're dealing with a portion of nine custodians, I think, a portion of 12 custodians, I think nine of them, who during the period in the late 80s did not receive service credit. They're custodians employed by the Bloomington Public School District. They did not receive service credit because contributions were not taken and their service was not reported to PERA. There are two different provisions. I think you have two different approaches to solving this. The general approach is to authorize the service credit purchase. The two bills, the two different approaches really differ on who has to pay the bulk of the full actuarial value in this case. The Osment bill would provide that the school district pays the bulk of the cost. Senator Larson also, or Representative Larson also has a bill which I believe it's in our packets. Oh, this is a second yellow number two. This is two. House File 2546 is the Representative Larson bill, and this would have the State General Fund pay the bulk of the service credit purchase. We need to take some testimony about who knows what happened in Bloomington.
Representative Osment, Representative Larson, testimony on the Bloomington matter. Do we have any?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I'd like if Mr. Larson would discuss this with you.
Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. We have with us today one of the employees, Dave Kaczynski. We also have Kingsley Holman representing the Bloomington School District, and also Shane Allers, who is also representing employees in this case. And Mr. Chair, if you'd like to take testimony from them regarding this, it appears that we're moving toward some compromise, but perhaps a brief narrative would help us frame the issue.
Let's hear what they have today, yes.
Go ahead, Shane.
Give us your name and then go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Shane Allers, and I'm with the Service Employees International Union, Local 284. The employees of the Bloomington schools that are in question here are members of Local 284. And the history of this is that it was came to our attention a little better than a year ago that there was some employees whose hire date for PERA purposes was later than the hire date that the seniority list showed that they were. So we started researching it and found that they were not given service credits. I believe some legislation was drafted and was presented a couple of weeks ago at this Pension Commission meeting. And the school district subsequent to that was able to produce some information that they've given to PERA that has now said that they were excluded. Several of these folks were excluded from getting pension credit for either temporary, because they were temporary employees, or full-time students. That just came to our knowledge last Friday, and we've been trying to work through that to come up with to verify that information, because that is not the recollection of the employees. So that's kind of where what got us here.
I'm Kingsley Holman, representing the school district, and I should point out that both sides have discussed this with Mary Vanek, and she has, I think, recommended certain language that takes care of it, and so we're basically in agreement with the fact that this should be determined by the pension association or commission, and whoever is eligible then should receive it, but that the eligibility should be dependent upon their recommendation understanding. I think we're all in agreement with that. We believe that the number of applicants has been drastically reduced from the documentation that we have presented. So it comes down basically to who's going to pay for it. And since this is something that goes back 21 to 17 years, it seems to me that the statute of limitations has given the school district the exemption on this matter, and if that's going to be lifted, then it would seem to me only just that the Larson bill and its method of financing govern the matter. But basically, I guess we have come to an agreement about the facts.
Do we know the amount?
That's not capable of any computation at this point.
$250,000. Ms. Vanek, are you with us?
That's if all of them are eligible.
Mr. Chair, I think we and Ms. Vanek can provide us with the exact number, but a number of us met this morning regarding this issue, and I think we came up with a number that worst-case scenario was somewhere under $200,000.
Mr. Chair, members, Mary Vanek, PERA. We've looked at the records and determined of the nine individuals who were originally questioned as to eligibility, there's only one that we cannot provide evidence that he was legitimately excluded. He is the only person that we think would qualify to purchase the service. Five of the individuals. Records indicate that when they were initially hired, they were full-time students. Full-time students were excluded from PERA if they were part-time employees, and these individuals were all reported in the record as full-time students, part-time employees. Three of the other individuals were recorded as part-time temporary employees. Temporary employee is somebody who's hired to a position for less than 6 months. All three of those individuals were reported as soon as they were put on a permanent classification, and they had accrued 3 months, 4 months, and 4 months, respectively. So we believe they were correctly excluded under our temporary provision. The other individuals served for 9 months classification of part-time temporary. 9 months does not meet the temporary definition. So unless the school district can prove otherwise through earnings that the individual didn't make enough, we think that one person would be eligible to purchase service. And the cost would be, for the member, $2,131, and for the school district, $21,431.
So are you're pretty certain that it's just going to be limited to this one employee ultimately?
Mr. Chair, they're the only other individual that I still would like further clarification on is the gentleman at the table, Mr. Kaczynski. Although the records that the school district did produce indicate that he was a full-time student when he was initially hired, and when he was no longer a student and became a permanent employee, that's when he was reported for coverage in PERA. If there is any information in between that time, because he was a student according to their records for 2 years and 5 months, if his status would have changed earlier than that, then we could look at that. But the other ones, every indication is they were appropriately excluded.
So let's say that case, the language allows you to further, if we passed it, that would allow you to deal with that case. And if the facts turn out such, would that just double the cost of what you just described, roughly, or not?
Mr. Chair, it would depend upon how much time he could purchase. If he were allowed, if it turned out that he wasn't a full-time student and he were allowed to purchase the entire amount, the school district cost is estimated to be about $54,780.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, the language is included in House File 2546 that we always look for that says only periods of employment when the eligible person would have been eligible for coverage can be purchased, and that's the language we always look for in these kind of bills.
Can you tell us, do you have any, and you may not have any advice, you just want the fund to be made whole. Do you have any advice on whether the district or the state should pay for that? The employer portion? You don't have to have advice. Do you have any precedent on this that you want to point to?
Mr. Chair, I do recall that several years ago, I believe it was Dakota County, was required to make payments for an individual who was excluded. We just recently enacted legislation or moved on legislation here for a Faribault firefighter who the city failed to report correctly, and they're going to be picking up the additional cost of that purchase.
Okay. Questions?
Comfort language is in both bills.
Thank you. I think it revolves around who pays here. Let's hear the case again why the district shouldn't pay. 21 years old? I mean, it's a 21-year-old problem, therefore the district shouldn't pay.
Well, as you know, the statute of limitations has long gone by. That would have meant normally the school district wouldn't pay. Now with the 21 to 17 years that have gone by, and no action was taken by the applicant at that time, we think that the justice would require that it no longer is a bill to the school district, but to the state.
The true statute of limitations only applies to a court action anyway. It doesn't apply to what you guys do.
Yeah, I think your reference to statute of limitations confuses us a little. Mr. Martin?
Members, I think the statute of limitations is being referred to here is actually the three-year limitation in Chapter 353 of Minnesota statutes that governs when how far back PERA can correct unreported members or unreported contribution amounts. So I think that's what's referred to broadly as the statute of limitations. If there are general state statute of limitations, which tend to be 6 or 7 years in most cases under contract and other things. That applies to when a court can be involved, does not limit the legislature from looking at the issue.
If we're going to use statute of limitations, then we put ourselves totally out of business because every single thing is 30 years old.
We are not bound by any statute of limitations.
It's got to be the district, doesn't it?
Yeah. Except we go with statute of limitations. Every single item.
We should make your arguments in public rather than privately.
Yeah.
We're going to make these conversations public.
What?
I think should be laid out publicly rather than just in between you folks.
Yeah. I think there's some hesitancy on the commission to bring this over to the finance committee and say that the state should pay for this because the state really didn't have anything to do with this. So I think it's going to have to be the district. And a member has raised whether there should be a local approval clause on here. And I think people are a little concerned if you put a local approval clause on, the district will say no, and we'll be right back here. So, Representative Larson?
Well, Senator Pogemiller, members, I can address the issue of why my bill draft or my bill introduction has the state pay. It goes a little bit to the, and let's see if I find it in here in Mr. Martin's memo that that discusses on page 2. I just quote from, without culpability, the state should not have financial responsibility unless school district finances do not permit it to bear the financial responsibility. And my point, Mr. Chair, in this is that we're still trying to get to the bottom of who is eligible and who is not. As a representative of an area that of Bloomington schools, we obviously don't want to see any hit to our school funding as well. We also understand that there may be some obligation here for the school district. So initially when we drafted this, my feeling was that we should try to resolve it for those employees that were eligible. However, not knowing what the rules were at that time, we're not prepared necessarily to say that the school district ought to pay. If that's the will of the commission, we understand that and believe that ultimately at the end of this process, we need the employees that were eligible for this benefit to receive it. And if that means that the school district is liable for that, I understand with the process that Ms. Vanek has set forth, while she believes that one or two of the employees is eligible, representatives of the employees this morning, Mr. Allers had said that that perhaps that process would allow them to bring additional information forward as well. And I just want to confirm that that's part of our process as well.
I think it is under the way it's drafted.
Okay. Thank you, Mr.
So Smith moves 2523,
yep,
which has the language you had referenced in the other bill. And I think it should be pointed out that you don't need a local – the way the bill is drafted, it says that if the district – on page 2, Mr. Martin, why don't you point the language out?
Members, if you turn to page 2, starting in line 27, this permits Bloomington to pay the difference if the eligible person pays the member contribution. And if the school district declines to pay that, it's simply subtracted from future state aid. So it's, it has the same economic impact, but does not actually physically compel the school district to cut a check.
Representative Thiessen.
However it's done, typically.
Okay.
This is the boilerplate.
This is kind of the boilerplate way. So Smith moves House File 2523 be incorporated. Discussion. And do you understand that they will still be discussing your fact situation?
Yes.
The language allows you to be covered if the fact situation bears it. Okay. Discussion. All in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
All opposed. Motion adopted. Good work. Number 3, Mr. Burke.
Members, number 3 deals with an individual who was in the job share program, and the commission has looked at this once before and brought it back for another consideration. What you have is a very brief one-page memo by me pointing out some of the factual circumstances and the advantages and disadvantages of handling this either as a one-person bill or to handle the whole group. The BA010 amendment would allow a single individual who was in the job share program and who received fractional service credit rather than full service credit because the individual was in that program to receive full service credit. The B025 amendment is an alternative, and that is an effort to try to address the similar situation of other people who, or all people rather, who were in that job share program. There are some problems with either amendment. With the more global approach, the B025 approach, there is difficulty in that it's impossible to really identify all the individuals who took part in that program. So it's not possible to provide an equitable solution to all individuals. Some of those comments, I turn it back to the
Mr. Bergstrom. And while Mr. Bergstrom's coming up, I understand for number 15 there are some people from Mankato here. Is that correct? for the MSRS Correctional. Is that correct? Are there some people from Mankato here? Or Moose Lake, maybe?
We're out of town.
Okay, and then Senator Larson, is there someone here for your bill, number 13?
He isn't here.
Not here? Oh, Larson's not here. Okay.
There is someone.
Okay. Mr. Bergstrom?
Mr. Chair, my name is Dave Bergstrom, and I'm the director of the state retirement system. And as we, as you talked about this last time, there was some inconsistency of how job share employees were granted credit as related to employees who work part-time. We are uncomfortable with either amendment at this point for a couple of reasons. One, the service credit was granted under the law in effect at the time. Generally, we use the law in effect to determine what the service credit is. It was part of the terms of employment that of these job share employees when they were hired. The liability for the one individual is about $76,000. And if you add the whole group, the cost is probably in the vicinity of about $2 million. I did call the Department of Employee Relations. They have vague recollection that there are about 200 people that use the program. We estimate we have 30 to 50 employees who this would affect. We don't have them identified on our database, so the only way to identify them, quite frankly, would be to either go through literally thousands of files or put some blurb in our newsletter that says if you were a job share employee, yes, because at the time we did not identify these people individually. Bottom line, Mr. Chair, it does have a cost to the program.
And they were all at 50%? That numbers you just gave us, or just some of them?
Mr. Chair, my understanding is that they were all at 50%, but again, I'm not all that familiar. The ones that I've dealt with all had 50% time.
Okay, questions? Representative Thiessen?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I think that the issue here is, for whatever reason, when these programs were put together, some employees who were working the same amount of time were treated differently than others, and that, I think, is the equitable argument here for us to take into account. I know that Ms. Pisa is here as well. I don't know if you want to hear from her anymore, but that's kind of what's motivating the legislation. Okay. My sense is, you know, if we are going to do something, maybe the best thing, since the fund doesn't even know who all would be within this, that we would do the more narrow bill, knowing that it sets precedent, but I don't want to put the work into the MSRS to have to go out and identify all these folks either, which the broader bill would seem to require. So that would be knowing we get to the same end both ways by setting the precedent, but it doesn't perhaps put as much burden on the MSRS.
Yeah. Do you see any other remedy here?
Mr. Chair, you know, you could require actuarial value. The employees obviously would not see that equitable. There are no, you know, they paid their deductions on the contributions, so I don't see really any viable solutions at this point.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Osment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Thiessen. I'm trying to get my hands around the problem that we're trying to deal with here.
Sure.
And I have a question because, to me, a part-time position, regardless of the amount of time that was actually spent, because if a shared position means we had one full-time equivalent, but it was actually two individuals that were covering that time, whatever portion, it may have been 50-50, may have been 75-25, may have been whatever, but it was aware that we had a need for one full-time person but could be shared by more than one individual to cover that need. But part-time is actually when the employer has a need and it is trying to cover a portion of a full-time equivalent. And so one situation in job share was a benefit of the employee so that they could actually maybe work half-time but still cover a full-time need. Part-time, trying to get as many hours as you can and hopefully would work that up to full-time. If the people were paid or their pension is determined by the amount of time that they actually spent, just because a full-time or a part-time person would be eligible for, if they went over 50%, would be eligible for more pension, why would we want to do that same thing for two people that decided to split the activity? Do you understand my question?
And that's, I do, Mr. Chair, I do understand the question, and that's, I think, a point in the discussion that hasn't, a perspective that hasn't come up before in this discussion. You know, the in terms of whether it's the employer or the employee making the decision not to work full-time, and I guess I was just going under the assumption that it was the employee who was deciding to work a part-time position as opposed to being not choosing to do that, but doing that at the employer's behest. And so I hadn't thought about that point, and you raise a good issue.
Thank you. I'm not ready to go with this.
Sure.
Roberta Pisa. It was not just for the benefit of the employee that that program was created. My understanding that that program is created so that the state...
Could you speak up maybe a little?
My understanding is that that program was created by the legislature to recruit and retain employees, and that it was an additional option available to the state. Obviously, it was a benefit for some individuals who wish to work part-time, but that it was not just for the benefit of the employee, that it was designed to be a benefit for the employer as well. And clearly for me, it's the equity argument, and I think Representative Wardlow, I've forgotten which one of you said it, the point about the length of service credit, and why should those two people be treated as getting the same service credit as the part-time employee. And I guess all I can really go back to is if there were three people, two of them doing, all three of them working 50% time, one of them in a part-time position, two of them in a job share position, that the part-time person working for a year got a full year's service credit. The two job share people in the same comparable position also working for a full year did not get that full year service credit. Mr. Burke raises a couple of points about Mr. Bergstrom also raises a point about the conditions of employment and that the employees accepted those conditions at the time. And clearly that's true, and nobody's suggesting that the MSRS is not applying that piece of the law in the way that it was written. I was certainly aware that my benefits, my pay, my sick leave, my annual leave were being prorated based on the number of hours that I worked, and I accepted that. What I didn't know until a year ago in the meeting with Mr. Bergstrom was that part-time employees were not being treated in the same way for retirement benefits for service credit. And I guess, frankly, it's just difficult for me to imagine the legislature, the members of the legislature developing the program and saying, we'll create the program, we want to recruit and retain. In my case, it was retain people in the state workforce. It was intended to be an improvement over part-time options, or we would have been working part-time. We'll give them the same wages, the same benefits, but we'll make sure that they don't get the same credit for retirement benefits. It just is that basic, the basic unfairness of that. Anybody I have talked to who about this in my most objective presentation will say, once they get it, well, that's not fair, and it's not. And I think the fact is that you can't correct this for everyone. There are people who have retired. If there were 200 people in the program, many of them are no longer state employees. So you may not be able to uniformly and fully apply a remedy. But in my mind, that doesn't justify not correcting or finding a remedy for those situations that you can correct. And obviously, that's why I'm bringing the bill.
Representative Osmond.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to the testifier, I would argue that there's no remedy needed, because if we had, when we were considering putting in job sharing, if that would have meant we were going to have the obligation for two pensions for 50% of the work, I don't think it would have passed. It was understanding was is that things would be split, and that of course meant benefits as well as costs. And I don't know, are you telling me that people that were in the job share program were of the understanding that they would be able to work 50% of the time and receive 100% pension?
No, of course, I can't speak for everybody, but that was not my understanding. But it is my understanding now that job share employees paid into the retirement system at the same rate, the same amount that a part-time person would have paid in. And that pension benefits, although they are based partly on years of service, are also based on salary. And that by people that have stayed with the job share program could certainly have been working part-time, thereby reducing their salary. Certainly my salary was reduced for the period of time that I was job sharing.
Okay.
Follow-up.
Yes, Representative Osmond.
Just to that point, I believe that with regard to part-time people, they may have been paying the same rate as the job share, but once you go over 50%, then it's really to try and encourage the reason why the obligation then starts going towards 100% of the pension is to try and not have a disincentive for people to be able to actually become full-time employees. You're trying to encourage people to become full-time. And so I think that's why there was such a difference in that overall effort.
Representative Thiessen.
Maybe we should lay this one over at this point.
Okay, I think it's it seems like the commission would need a lot more information as to the repercussions financially. So Thiessen moves to not incorporate at this time. Discussion. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, motion adopted. Thank you very much. Thank you, Ms. Pisa. Number five, apparently we have with an amendment, we can proceed with that one. We heard it the other day. Murph? Is Murph here?
Yes.
Do you have an amendment?
Yes.
Ms. Johnson?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Why don't you tell us, apparently you've come to some kind of understanding of what might work here?
I have, Mr. Chair. We did do the calculations, and
why don't you just refresh the case real quick?
This is a situation where Mr. Mooney, who is a MRF member, did not properly fill out a disability form with MRF until many years later, in fact, about 7.5 years later. And MRF actually does give credit if you're on workers' comp if you fill out the form. And he failed to do so. We don't know why. He said that a foreman may have been unaware of MRF provisions and told him he didn't need to until he was ready to go back to work. He only needs a little over 2 years to retire, and the cost, if he got the 7 years, would be quite extensive. It would be over $70,000. If instead he was awarded 2 years of credit, he could retire promptly in January, and then the cost was closer to around $14,000.
That's next January?
That's this coming January, 2007, okay. Yes. And so the idea is the session probably won't end until May, and he'd work a few more months, and the cost would be more reasonable. It's my understanding.
And what's the split? Who pays what here?
That's something for the commission to determine.
Okay.
As I understand it, Mr. Burek has drafted one amendment that would require Mr. Mooney to pay contributions at the rate of pay as when he came back to work, plus interest for 2 years. And I calculated that for Mr. Burek, and that's $13,125. The total cost of the service credit for 2 years is around $14,000. So if that amendment passes as it is, then he would pay most of the cost. And Mr. Representative Thiessen, I believe, worked with the city on the bill.
Representative Thiessen.
Can we have extra Mr. Burke talk? There's three amendments sitting out here. I'm not sure which one is being.
Which one do you want?
I want to find out.
My understanding, Representative Thiessen, is the amendment that you wanted is the S-1562-A1 amendment, the amendment that I just passed, that was just passed out.
What this amendment
does is it limits the individual to receiving two additional years of service credit rather than up to 7.5. It clarifies the salary upon which the employee contributions would be computed. They'd be based on the calendar year 1992 salary. That year was selected because the first full year, full calendar year of employment after the individual came back from the injury. And under this amendment, the individual would pay the employee contributions plus interest, and the employer would pay the remainder of the full actuarial value for those 2 years of additional service that would be obtained or coverage that would be obtained.
Okay. Minneapolis? Murph, this works for Murph?
This works for Murph, yes. Okay.
Mr. Chairman, Karen Lowry Wagner with the City of Minneapolis. I just want to, and I'm sorry, it's kind of difficult to hear, what portion is the city going to be responsible for, or is the
$800, it sounds like. Is that right?
Yes, it's a very low amount, Mr. Chair, because the cost of Mr. Mooney's contribution under the language of the amendment is a substantial part, $13,125 versus about $14,500.
That's much better than the original $80,000, Mr. Chair. The other question I had is regarding if there is the local approval clause. We had asked for that during previous testimony.
Is there one on the original bill here?
Mr. Chairman, members, there isn't a local approval.
There is
clause.
Not.
It was my understanding that the.
One on.
Mr. Chair, can we lay this one over for about 5 minutes and go on to something else? If that would be okay.
Okay. So we'll set it aside for a couple minutes. Now, you know, Minneapolis should be a little more enthusiastic, I think, on this one.
Yeah.
Because there are other options. You want to do number six?
Sure.
Number six, Senator Bedsell.
Mr. Chair, this issue we talked about a little earlier, and both Representative Osment was not here, and neither was Senator Larson, and I think they both wanted to be part of the discussion. This is the St. Louis Park police officer issue. The members may recall last year, the circumstance here, we had an individual who was a member of PERA's Police and Fire, who was also a member of the military, I believe it was the National Guard, and he was deployed in October of 2004, at which time he took a voluntary leave of absence. And he married just before he left, and it was, his high school sweetheart. And then he died about a year ago in October of 2005. The St. Louis Park city manager and police chief were here about a year ago urging us to make a finding that he died in the line of duty as a St. Louis Park police officer so that he would then become eligible for a PERA pension. And that was necessary because of the shortness of the marriage. We did not do that in the Senate. Actually, then Senator Kelly offered a floor amendment to accomplish that, and I offered an amendment requiring basically the St. Louis Park City to pay for the cost, as well as also to say that the surviving spouse was not going to receive a benefit if she were to remarry. That amendment went on. Senator Kelly withdrew his amendment to the pension bill. However, it was still done in the Agriculture, Environment, Community Development Bill in the special session. which, and that bill, of course, because in a special session, did not go through the House Ways and Means Committee or the Senate Finance Committee. And the language that was adopted in there was a little unusual. It said that it applies not just to the one situation, but it says that for a member of police and fire fund dies, becoming disabled, you've got the language of the packet. And it says, for purposes, the line of duty includes active military service, which applies virtually to everybody who's been deployed in this fund. And I believe Ms. Vanek told me last year there were about 80 folks that may be in that situation now. And, of course, it doesn't apply to individuals who are government employees who are in the Guard and Reserve, who get deployed, and then they die, and they're not covered by this language because this is only for one fund. So it does raise a number of policy issues. I've distributed an email I received this morning, and members may well have received as well, too, from another member of the fund who has some concerns about this. The Star Tribune ran an article over the weekend on it, they talked to me, and, in fact, one of the concerns I had was that I was portrayed primarily by Carol Levin, as a big bad legislator, namely me beating up on a poor widow. And, of course, I asked the reporter afterwards, I say, now, did you ask the widow how much she was receiving in her benefits? And, of course, he did not. The information was never provided to the Pension Commission. I think she would have received something of $250,000 cash settlement and a group life insurance payout. According to this article, she's believed to be receiving about $1,000 a month from her federal death annuity, and then she receives on top of that the $1,700 a month police survivor benefit. So beyond the fact that I think that this violated the single subject requirement of the Constitution, where we put a pension issue in a bill that had nothing to do with pensions, I think that there's a lot of things there. Why was the language so broad? I think why does it apply to only the people in police and fire who are deployed, not anybody else? Who's going to pay for the funds? Who's going to pay these costs? And so, Mr. Chair, I think that I would like to see us go back to the proposal that I think the Pension Commission looked at a year ago, and that's to say if St. Louis Park really believes that this is just and equitable, then maybe we ought to adopt some language to require St. Louis Park to pay that cost.
Do you have – is there an amendment that does that?
Well, we had the packet from last time. I don't remember what they
– So you want to offer the 08?
I guess I
do. Is that the third one?
Yes.
Well, Mr. Chairman.
And is that – just to clarify – does that clear out the language that was – okay, is there other language we have to – so what's the situation? If this passed, what would be the situation in the future? Because apparently what passed in that conference committee was general language.
I would like to repeal what happened last year.
06.
Yeah.
Okay, that's –
three amendments.
Okay, 06. Mr. Martin, so you would need 06 and 08 together to accomplish that?
Yes, members.
So Bedsold is moving 06 and 08. And the effect of that, Mr. Martin, is?
Members, 06 would repeal the 2005 special session law. And the 08 part would, since the benefit is already in force, would charge St. Louis Park for the cost of this particular benefit. Okay. Given to former police officer Day, Day's widow.
So Ms. Day, Amy Day, would not lose her benefit?
No. There's nothing in the language, members, that makes the repealer roll back to the effective date of the first special session in 2005. So, no, she has been awarded the benefit and would continue to receive it, but the cost would be paid for by St. Louis Park. I read the two amendments together.
Senator Larson.
Well, Mr. Chairman, you know, we spent so much time on this, and, you know, this was really outrageous action, I think, to put this language in a conference committee report and not tell Senator Betzwold or any of us about it. And I didn't know about it until I read it in the paper. And that's why we have a pension commission, is to deal with these issues. And if we start doing this monkey business outside of the activity and the approval of the pension commission, we got enough of a mess in a lot of these pension groups without getting it more fouled up. So I support Senator Betzwald's motion.
Any other discussion? Anybody want to testify? Mr. Bagnoli, are you here? Please. The only reason I asked for Mr. Bagnoli, apparently he represents St. Louis Park now. Mr. Choi was made city attorney in St. Paul. He used to represent St. Louis Park. He's now city attorney in St. Paul. Welcome.
Good morning. My name is Tom Harmoning. I'm the city manager for the city of St. Louis Park. Thanks very much for the opportunity to speak to you this morning. I'm reminded of an old saying, no good deed goes unpunished in this particular situation. Last year when Amy Day's husband died in Iraq, as we were helping her work through a variety of benefits-related issues, we were informed that in 2003 the state legislature passed a bill, and I think that might have been passed out of this commission.
No, it did not. It was opposed by the commission. It was jammed into a conference committee just like this provision.
That may very well be so. What we were told is that in 2003 a bill was passed that provided a pension benefit to the widow of a public employee who was killed not in the line of duty, whether in service to their city or in service to their country, but in a snowmobiling accident or something like that.
That's correct.
Because of that situation, we felt it was appropriate to at least ask the question of the pension committee and PERA if a similar consideration could be given to the spouse of David Day. We did appear before this commission, and you made it very clear to us that was something that you didn't feel was appropriate, and that was accepted. We also appeared before the PERA board and asked them a similar question, and their position was not dissimilar from your own. From there, the situation really took a life of its own, and as city manager, I really wasn't in control of what was going on at the state legislature after that. So we were simply a city who was asking the question of whether the state would consider a waiver in this particular situation, and were told no. Subsequently, legislation was passed which did provide for that, and that now seems to be the debate at hand. And to me, it seems to be more of an issue of process than anything else. I think there's a feeling that the process was violated. That's not something that was in my control as a City of St. Louis Park representative. We don't work, nor do I have any authority over what happens at the state legislature. The irony here, I think, the ultimate irony is this. If David Day had been killed a year ago in St. Louis Park, serving St. Louis Park residents, this pension would be paid to his surviving spouse. So if he was killed in St. Louis Park, as I understand the law, the pension would be paid, serving only residents of St. Louis Park. But because he was killed serving the residents of the state of Minnesota, St. Louis Park is being expected to pay that benefit. And that's where we struggle a bit with this situation.
Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Senator Betzel.
Mr. Chair, had David Day died in the line of duty performing duties as a St. Louis Park police officer, yes, his surviving widow would have received the death benefits. However, the federal government would not have paid his widow anything, even though he was a member of the National Guard, because he did not then have died in the line of duty as a soldier. Okay? You can't be both at the same time. That's the argument that St. Louis Park made a year ago. You sat here and said he died as a St. Louis Park police officer in Iraq, and he didn't. He didn't. Now, your lobbyist, John Choi, knew that this was going in that conference committee bill. I don't know whether the lobbyist reported back to the city council. I impute his knowledge to you folks. Your legislators who represent St. Louis Park knew that that was going to be going in. The members of the pension commission weren't told that. So if you were kept in the dark, we were kept in the dark. But I have a feeling you folks knew what was in play. And the fact is, as I say, We opposed what happened in 2003. I carried that omnibus bill. But if there was a distinction to be made, that widow was going to receive zero if the pension wasn't paid. So I think the sympathies were to give it. The widow here receives a federal pension and the state one. And the way the language is written, it's going to apply to everybody. And St. Louis Park doesn't care where the money comes from. Your legislators apparently don't know where it's coming from. How are we going to now turn down every other soldier who gets, guardsman, reservist, who gets called up, deployed, and dies, and we're going to tell every one of them, you're not going to get a state pension simply because, you know, you're not in the Amy Day situation? Or do we turn around and say, you're all going to get it? And how are we going to pay for it? I don't know. But you can't double dip. You can't get two of them. You can't die in the line of duty as a soldier and as a police officer. You pick one. You wanted both. Why?
Mr. Chair, members of the commission, I'm not receiving anything out of this, Senator Betzel.
You lobbied for it.
And quite candidly, I think you're mixing policy with how much money a spouse should get if her husband is killed in Iraq. I think there are two very separate issues.
But
lastly, and I'll reiterate this again, if Mr. Day had been killed in St. Louis Park,
but he wasn't.
We know you're in a difficult position as city manager, so okay, please continue.
If Mr. Day had been killed a year ago in St. Louis Park, serving St. Louis Park residents in a traffic accident or any other situation, we wouldn't be here today. We simply asked the question in consideration of what happened in 2003. It was a reasonable question to ask. I think it is.
Did you, Mr. Chair,
Senator Betzel,
did you know that this was going to go into that omnibus bill?
Senator, Mr. Chair, Senator Betzel.
Well, I guess, you know what? I don't think it's actually relevant. So it really doesn't make any difference, Senator Betzel.
It does to me, Mr. Chair.
But I think in terms of the decision we have to make, the issue is related to, is the fund going to be made whole or not? So I what, who knew, and so forth, I don't think is relevant other than maybe perhaps in a different sense. So, Senator, Representative Osmond.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think it should also be pointed out that this so-called double-dipping accusation would not apply had this marriage lasted or had been over a year in length. Then the same situation that this widow is in would have been identical to what current law is. And so I don't think that it's appropriate to say that somehow that this is because eligible for two different pensions that all of a sudden that's a high or a big offense. The only offense is that not enough time occurred between the marriage and the death.
I think, members, let's put this in perspective a little bit. There is another option here. The state could pay for this. And if a bunch of state legislators think people's circumstance like the Day family should get this, then a bunch of state legislators should pay for it. Because the issue today is whether all the other pensioners in that fund are going to pay for it or whether St. Louis Park's going to pay for it. Third option is the state pays for it. So what perhaps we could do, this bill has to go to the Finance Committee anyway. Why don't we put in some language that says if the Finance Committee is willing to pay for this, then St. Louis Park doesn't have to pay for it. I personally would support that. But I can't support having all the other pensioners pay for it. Because what did they do? And as a statewide policy, if we take a position that because some legislator, and I don't blame St. Louis Park City for this, if some legislator can pass a bill making somebody pay for it and then they get to take the credit, I'd rather have that legislator take the credit after they came up with the money. Let me be real blunt, and I do mean that for the authors and for the conference committee. If this is such a good idea, the conference committee should have came up with the money.
Mr. Chair, I don't disagree that the state of Minnesota should step up to the plate on this, but I don't see that we need to repeal anything to do that. We can hand that handle that as a separate appropriation item, and we can deal with that issue without negatively impacting the legislation that established this benefit.
Well, I think, Representative Opperman, I think the way this is drafted, that pension will be paid. And now the question is, who's going to pay for it? And I'm suggesting, right now, the way it's drafted, St. Louis Park pays for it. I'm suggesting we put some language in that says St. Louis Park pays for it if the state doesn't appropriate the money this year. That way, the issue is before the Finance Committee. And if they choose to pay for it, then St. Louis Park's fine. Is that a compromise that could work here?
Mr. Chair, I think we can work on that without passing anything out of here today.
Then I think we'll be back here next year with the funds. You did read the memo from the fund, didn't you? They passed a resolution.
Board resolutions. The third page down.
Third page down, I guess, the PERA board resolution. You know, they're in the position of all the funds. They just want to be made whole. Representative Osmond, I think if you add this language that the Finance Committee consider this and the Appropriations Committee in the House, my guess is they might pay some. Now, I understand the governor's interested in this, too. All right? You're telling me a governor and a candidate for governor and a person who is a well-respected member of the House with the two conference committee chairs can't figure out a way to come up with a few bucks?
Yes.
So Bedsold moves the A6 and the A8 with additional language that says that if the state appropriates money, St. Louis Park only has to make up the difference.
And Mr. Chair, I do want to make sure that we do repeal it, the previous language. I wonder if Ms. Vanek could tell us, how many other people are similarly situated who are currently in this fund who have been deployed?
She's shaking her head. She doesn't know.
Doesn't know. Okay.
On the Bedsold motion.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Smith.
My understanding, the A6 is just a flat-out repeal, and the A8 yes. addresses St. Louis Park's liability.
Right.
Can we vote on those separately?
Sure. Okay. On the A8 first, with the language that says if the state pays it, St. Louis Park doesn't have to.
Yes.
Okay?
Yeah.
So on the A8, discussion. All in favor say aye.
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 All opposed? Motion's adopted. Now on the repeal A6 or 06. Does everybody have a clear understanding that if, thank you very much. Does everybody have a clear understanding? What is the, Ms. Vanek? If this language is not repealed, what's the situation? Will we have to come back and pass language for any other city that is in the situation?
Mr. Chair and members, yes. If the provision is not repealed as we learn more about those who are on military leave, and there are 80-some individuals, is my recollection, among the plans. There may be more. I haven't done any analysis recently.
But 80 are not going to be in a situation where this benefit might apply.
That's correct, Mr. Chair, because we don't know the marital status of all of them. But for each individual...
Well, the odds of a death are pretty slim.
For any other individual to whom this may apply, we would then have to come back before the commission to get the funding for the benefit.
Okay. Are members clear? Okay, on the A6, all in favor say aye.
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 All opposed?
No.
No.
I believe the motion does not prevail. Okay. Thank you. Are you ready, Representative Thiessen, on number 5?
We just voted on the amendments.
Those were for incorporation.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to make a statement before we leave the topic.
Representative Murphy.
At the time that this, when the Pension Commission took its position, had a long conversation with the Mr. Choi about how we were also going to be debating the whole issue that brought this about, which is how long, you know, is it 1 year, 3 years, 5 years that people that are married have to be married before they're qualified for pensions for their spouses. And that is a topic that that's come before us this year. It's come before us every single year. And I talked to Mr. Choi about the need to have discussions to determine what the proper number of years is and if there should be a period of time, but that the Pension Commission needed more time. And the next thing after that conversation I heard about this issue was that it was passed in that other bill. And we didn't do anything about the issue of time then during that interim, and we didn't do anything about it during this past interim. And so we still got before us the policy decisions of the policy that the various boards have, that it takes 5 years or 3 years or 2 years or 1 year to qualify for the spousal, to qualify for the benefit. And we must take that up in a situation where we don't have a person before us and a situation before us, and we have to talk about it with the funds and come to a conclusion that is going to carry us through more than the next circumstance that comes before us in a special legislation for a special person. That is my feeling. I will stop now.
Okay. I think we probably need to do some work on that language because it only applies to police and fire now. So we'll bring it up at another commission meeting. But we are where we're at right now. Okay, let's go back to number five.
Mr. Chair, thank you. I think we don't have language, but if I could describe
okay.
This is from Ms. Hear any more testimony.
Thiessen makes that motion. Discussion. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed. Motion's adopted. Okay, let's take number, what's that one? I want to get two others done before we go to the teachers, to the Minneapolis teachers. And number 13, okay. I want to do number 9 and number 13. Number 9, Mr. Martin.
The revisions, yeah.
St. Paul here.
Members, this is a service credit purchase. It was on the schedule for an earlier commission meeting, but the commission ran out of time to hear it. It relates to the former mayor of St. Paul and an election that was made. The mayor made an election of the PERA defined contribution plan shortly after taking office. The PERA general plan would have been the optimal pension coverage, but for whatever reason, the mayor did not choose that coverage, now recognizes that it was a mistake and seeks a legislative authorization to change the retirement benefit coverage selection made previously.
Welcome.
Commission Chair, members of the Commission, Ron Guilfoyle, Risk Manager, City of St. Paul. As part of your packet, I think you will find a copy of a resolution passed by the City Council endorsing Mr. Kelly's request to change to a defined benefit program and authorizes the city to make an expenditure of approximately $8,000 for the increased contribution the employer would have to make if that switch is allowed.
I see that. That's on lines 33 through 35. State funds affected? Thank you. Questions for St. Paul? And resolutions in St. Paul have to be passed by the council and signed by the mayor?
That is correct.
By the current mayor?
Yeah. That.
This has been signed by the current mayor.
I don't have that. Mr. Chair, members of the commission, that resolution was passed on December 14th of last year and signed by a representative of then Mayor Kelly.
Is the current mayor supportive of this?
Yes, the current mayor is in support of the resolution.
Okay, thank you.
Do you have the language that makes
them
retirement age?
Ms. Vanek.
Mr. Chair and members, the dollars involved for Mr. Kelly, if he were allowed to switch his coverage to the coordinated plan of PERA, would mean that we would have to transfer $56,486 to the post fund to fund his defined benefit. The current value of his defined contribution plan account is just over $45,140. That would be transferred to the para defined benefit plan, and then Mr. Kelly and the city would have to make up the difference of roughly $11,343 payment to PERA. That is just the PERA portion of the benefit.
Mr. Chair, former Mayor Kelly was a member of our legislators' plan, and if he is in PERA's coordinated plan, he would qualify for combined service, able to use his salary as mayor to apply to his legislator's time. The legislator's plan is a plan that is funded out of the state's general fund. We do not actually have an account from which to pay the benefits for future retirees. The present value cost is $216,650.
Okay. The $11,000 and the $8,000, St. Paul has an $8,000 number. Was that an earlier calculation?
Mr. Chair, members, yes. We did
very... Or is part of that what Mr. Kelly would pay of the $11,000?
Mr. Chair, Mr. Kelly would be required to pay part of the $11,000.
Okay, so the $8,000 was what the city would pay, and then Mr. Kelly would pay the other $3,000. Basically.
Mr. Chair, members, we gave them various scenarios. We gave them what would the contributions have been to the coordinated plan and the differences in those. We gave them the differences between the defined contribution and the defined benefit. But the defined contribution plan has increased in value since the initial numbers. So this is, you know, this is a moving target, but it is actually declining from the para side in terms of the city's cost.
So... All right, and the language would have to be drafted to make sure that the fund is held, made whole.
Yes.
Okay. Does that St. Paul hear anything there that changes the... Okay. Okay, what staff tell us the language? What page are we on? All right. So as the language is drafted, the 383, that's good to go. Does it have local approval on it? Does it need local approval?
Members... we have three amendments, possibly.
Okay.
The 384 amendment relates to the combined service annuity issue and includes that in the payment and the cost. Mr. Bergstrom has raised the issue that any PERA general plan coverage would have ramifications for legislators' plan coverage. The 385 amendment has to do with... what portion would be paid by the member versus what portion should be paid by the city. the press accounts were indicating that the city was going to pay 57% of the total, with the balance paid by the member. That doesn't reflect the current split in PERA General between the members and the employer. So if you want to reflect that split, which is a 52-48 split rather than a 57-43 split, the 385 amendment does that. The third one is the local approval issue. The bill does not have local approval currently, and this would add it.
Okay, so it sounds like we need all three amendments. Is that correct? Okay, so Smith moves the bill, which is, does it have a number yet?
No.
Okay, it's the 383 plus the 384 amendment, 385 amendment, and 386 amendment. All be incorporated. Anything to add? Okay. Does anybody want to hear from Mayor Kelly? He is here. Okay. Thank you very much. So on the Smith motion, discussion, all in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
All opposed, motion's adopted. Thank you. We have, before we do 13, we need to do 15. Apparently, some of the affected individuals have to leave by 11. So, Mr. Martin, number 15. Is that the correct one? Yes. Number 15.
Of course, the governor's bill, so I'll have to courtesy of
the members, this bill relate, or this draft, it's actually an amendment, contains the recommendations of the Department of Human Services and the Department of Corrections that were required under a 2005 law as an ongoing process of how to handle possible expansions of the MSRS correctional plan. And what the two sets of recommendations, which were due in mid-January, do is add 12 employment positions within the Department of Human Services. Those 12 positions cover 67 current state employees, and also adds 10 employment positions in the Department of Corrections, involving 40 state employees, to the MSRS correctional plan. The MSRS correctional plan is a quasi-public safety type pension plan. It was initially for prison guards only, now correctional counselors. It has been expanded since its creation in 1973 to include other than actual guards. The biggest set of expansions occurred in 74 with the addition of special teachers and various trades personnel, and then in 96 with the addition of several hundred state employees to the plan. The process, there are demands, requests within the two departments for coverage based on a sense of how much inmate contact individual employees have and how imperiled or hazardous their employment is. And so a process was set up by the 2005 session to allow the commission to handle these in a orderly way. And so this represents the recommendations of the two departments. Maybe wise have the two departments lay out what they're proposing here, and then if we wanted to discuss all the issues.
Agencies? So we have the 012. Wardlow puts the 012 before us for inclusion. Are there any straight technical ones that we should incorporate? Are the two agencies here? There's about six or seven amendments. Are there ones that are just purely technical?
No.
Okay. Welcome.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Karen McCarty. I'm the Human Resource Manager for the Department of Corrections.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Martha Watson. I'm the Director of Human Resources for the Department of Human Services.
Okay. We've been through the A12, I believe, the 012. Is there anything you wanted to add about that? Okay. Why don't we go through the amendments? 027? Mr. Martin, is that the first one, 027?
Okay. Yes, members. What is occurring here is you're asked to ratify a process where the legislature was not a participant in determining who is has a significant inmate or a patient contact in the various employment facilities that are covered by the correctional plan. When I went through the job descriptions for the various positions that were being recommended here, there were some that were clearly in, and there were some that were marginal or where there were issues involved. And those have been flagged for you if you the attachment F and the attachment G reflect, and they would be the markdown on the bottom. You just passed it. These reflect my spending time going through each of the job descriptions, trying to make sense from the job description whether there was documentation or verification of the extent of inmate contact. Wherever I was unclear or there were problems, I identified those. The BA027 amendment requires that the two departments for these particular job positions where I flag them to go to DOER and verify that these have sufficient contact for inclusion.
Does that work for the departments?
To take these to the Department of Employer Relations.
To discuss these with DOER?
Have you seen the amendment? Mr. Chairman, members of the commission, I don't have any objection to that, but DOER has no information about it. They're going to come right back to us. So I'm not exactly sure that it serves the purpose of the members who are interested in verification.
Mr. Chairman and members, I concur with that statement. They would come back to us.
So if we don't put this language in, what will happen?
They just go in. Then I think it's up to the members whether or not they approve the classes that we are recommending for inclusion.
And you're recommending all these?
Mr. Even Chairman, members of the commission, we are.
Are you certain?
Yes, sir.
Mr. Chairman, members of the commission, I would like to comment in that we have meticulously looked at these jobs. But as I had submitted information to you last week, the position descriptions are designed not to be a tool for you to evaluate whether their coverage is there. They are designed as a communication tool between employee and a supervisor. They're frequently written by employees or the supervisor, so they really are not necessarily an accurate reflection of how much offender time. What we did at the Department of Corrections was to have an HR person go out and examine these positions in detail, subsequently then meet with the warden and the associate wardens to go over the positions to be sure which ones had met the criteria of the statute. Then finally it was reviewed by our senior staff in the department. And then we have representatives from the exclusive reps here who are affected by this, and they have seen copies of what we're recommending. And it is my understanding that they completely support these positions as being ones that meet the standards.
So is there a way... Shouldn't someone go in and update the job descriptions then? So that someone 5 or 8 years from now?
We can do that. We certainly can do that.
Why don't we put some language in saying that the three of you, DOER and your two agencies, should get these all updated?
Okay.
I think that gets us, that accomplishes what we need for these job descriptions. And they are not covered then until you've upgraded the job descriptions. That's the way the language will read.
Okay.
Oh. I think the concern here is that today you know this.
Correct.
But what happens 5 or 8 years from now?
Mr. Chairman, members of the commission, as Ms. McCarty said, these position descriptions are for the purpose of communicating to the employee what they do on their job. They change on a regular basis.
Okay.
You know, we have a procedure where we review them every year when we do the employee's performance review and update them as need be. So, I mean, it's not a static job description. They change.
Isn't that the concern?
Well, the thing that we are using as the tool for ensuring that they have the proper requirements for going into the Correctional Employment Retirement Plan is our certification process. And the process that Ms. McCarty described for the Department of Corrections is very similar to the process that we used in the Department of Human Services.
So two people with the same job description, one might be certified and one might not?
Yes.
Correct.
Oh. Okay. I think we need to
hold off on 27.
Okay, let's move to 013 then.
Members, 013, if you turn to the BA012 base amendment, this would be the last four or five pages. If you turn to page 2 of that document, on the amendment relates to what's going on lines 2.3 and line 2.5. There's a recommended inclusion of some additional language relating to our correctional industry. Currently, a number of correctional industry people are in the plan. The question here is whether the inclusion of correctional industry references in the general statute incorporates new people that we have not seen, new positions. If it does not, and that's what we've been told, it does not. The dash 13 amendment simply indicates that the addition of that language is not intended to provide an expansion of the plan to any additional people beyond the folks who are in now. So it's a clarification that what seems to be a technical cleanup of the language doesn't become an inclusion where there's no documentation provided.
Mr. Chairman, members, that's exactly what it is a technical cleanup. It is not intended to add anyone else.
So we need the amendment. Okay, so Smith moves to incorporate the – who's doing this? Wardlow's got the amendment before us. Wardlow moves to incorporate 013 into the 012. Discussion? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Motion adopted. 14.
Members, the 14 amendment is a similar sentiment type amendment. It relates to unintended or potentially unintended impacts. Human Services is recommending moving all of the references to nursing personnel to a single spot within Minnesota Statutes, Chapter 352. By doing that, there will be some potentially unintended nursing personnel who would be changed potentially in the plan by virtue of simply moving the names around. There would be some correctional nursing personnel who may be potentially put in the plan without going through the process. So what dash 14 is not to undo what is being proposed, but just to not move the names around and unintendedly add corrections nursing personnel who have not gone through this process.
Mr. Chairman, members of the Commission, our intent is not to add anybody new as a result of that other than the ones that were specified in our proposal. It was just to put all of the nursing classifications in the same area.
Okay, Wardlow moves to 014. Discussion? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Motion adopted. 15.
Members, it may make sense, and I think I've made this recommendation later on, that there be a reformatting of a good portion of Chapter 352 at some future date. Trying to do that while you're also trying to make changes doesn't make a lot of sense. So I think as a future staff project, we will take a look at trying to get these all in a more reasonable order. But doing it on the fly or also doing a set of expansions may not be the time or place.
15
has to do with the storage clerk senior, which is a current position, and this requires that there be some substantiation of the duties. This is still an open question. I have gotten a job description for the new name, but the department is unable to find a copy of the job description for stores clerk senior. So
I don't have a clear idea of whether the new name, which is Office Administrative something or another, whether it is an actual just a name-only change or whether there were administrative duties.
Okay.
And the provision is the name of the occupational title is obviously broader than stores clerk senior, and so this potentially can bring in people for whom the substantiation was not laid out. So I did want to flag this for you.
Mr. Chairman, members, this is the same job. The stores clerk class went away over 10 years ago, and this is the same job.
So we want the amendment or don't want the amendment?
We want the coverage of the central services administrative classes.
Mr. Chairman, if I could add to that, if a job has been title changed, it's been done by the Department of Employee Relations.
I think we're good. Okay, we'll skip 15. 20?
The 20 amendment relates to a behavior analyst 2 position in MITO, which is a Department of Human Services program at Cambridge. It's my understanding that there's no incumbent in that behavior analyst 2 position. It's difficult to determine inmate contact in a position for a job which there is no incumbent. And so we're recommending that that we defer the change until a future date when there actually is an incumbent and the documentation can actually be done.
Mr. Chairman, members of the Commission, we're requesting this because the behavior analyst is part of a class series, and we already use the behavior analyst 1 and the behavior analyst 3 at the MITO program. We typically reallocate jobs between those classes as the person gains experience in the job. So in this case, we would have people employed as a behavior analyst 1 who have gained the appropriate experience, and it's time to promote them, but to promote them to behavior analyst 2 as would be appropriate.
Okay. Okay, we'll not do 20, 21?
Members, they're somewhat out of order because they came at different times. The BA-016 relates to...
16.
This is okay. Dash 16. This relates to some references back to a 1996-1997 set of laws where the members who were being newly moved to the MSRS correctional plan in 1996 and 1997 were given the option to not actually make the transfer if they chose not to. Those cross-references still sit in the law would potentially apply to these individuals. They don't apply uniformly through all the various subdivisions that move people within the correctional plan, so it's not equal treatment or comparable treatment in all instances. And if the suggestion here is that these people need to move because of the nature of their job, it would seem to be cleaner and more appropriate to actually move all members than to have some members choosing to not move. So this does away with what are presumably now obsolete references to this 96 statute.
Mr. Chairman, committee members, I do not know this issue, and I don't think it's appropriate for me to comment.
Let's put it in. If it doesn't work, you'll let us know.
Okay.
Wardlow moves the 16. Discussion. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed. Motion adopted. Okay. 17.
Members, 17 is to try and avoid the problem similar to the stores clerk senior, where a position title was done away with about a decade ago.
Okay, we didn't do stores clerk, so should we pass on this one?
No, this was the problem that was raised by stores clerk. That is that occupational titles change and they're not revisited in the statute. The statute gives a roadmap for who is in the plan and who's not in the plan. If the job titles are not kept current, it doesn't provide a workable regulation of the plan. So this provides a process for handling future occupational title changes.
Okay, Wardlow moves to 17.
You should be sure they're okay with it.
Discussion. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed. Motion adopted. 18.
Members, the 18 amendment relates to a bill that was was heard, and you took tentative action on, about some individuals down at Faribault. The delivery van driver did not have an inmate crew. Apparently, the delivery van driver now does have an inmate crew.
Could, 1 second. If someone's using an electronic device in the room, you have to stop. Please. That includes
Bluetooth, blueberry.
Blueberries, blackberries, blueberries, blackberries, greenberries, strawberries. Whatever. Can't use them. You cannot use them in the room. Thank you, Mr. Martin.
Okay, members, we had heard a bill that would provide for the inclusion of a number of laundry coordinators at Faribault, and also would move the delivery van driver as a separate bill. And this incorporates the delivery van driver, which seems to be the odd desire of the Pension Commission.
Representative Wardlow moves the 18. Discussion. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed.
Aye.
Motion adopted.
And then 19 is a suggestion that was made by the Department of Corrections for the Phoenix Pomiga program at St. Cloud. This is a program that no longer exists.
Wardlow moves the 19. Discussion. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed. Motion adopted. We have the 21 back there or not?
I think so.
I had a 21.
Earlier.
It was before the 16. Page 5, delete section 8. Don't have it?
Let it go.
Okay. Questions? Okay, does anybody in the audience want to testify on the bill on 012 as amended? Stakeholder groups are ready to go? Okay. They're nodding yes. Wardlow then moves the 012 as amended by all those various amendments, the 13, the 14, 16, 17, 18, and 19 have all been incorporated. All be incorporated in the omnibus bill. First one. Discussion. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed. Motion adopted. Thank you for your hard work on that. Appreciate it. Okay, Senator Larson, this will be the last one before we go to the teachers. Number 13.
Number 13.
Seems to me this has been before us again. Mr. Burr?
Back in 2 minutes.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, we have Representative Moe here and. Okay. Handouts? Okay.
Mr. Burr?
Members, this issue has been for you before. It was before you last year, I believe, and the Commission declined to take any action on it. This deals with an individual who terminated from
good work on that one, thanks.
Employment that was covered by the MSRS general plan. And subsequently, the individual became employed in a school that the Commission referred to as the Bug School. That is a school that received some funding from the federal government and various other sources. And because of the nature of that specific employment, employment in that school is not eligible for coverage by any of our Minnesota public pension plans. What the individual has requested is that that service be allowed to be credited in MSRS General. So basically the request is that although the individual has terminated from MSRS General employment, the individual is asking that the subsequent employment be treated as though it is in the plan. Now, this does raise some significant considerations. The Commission and legislature, to the best of my knowledge, has never allowed a terminated employee to continue in the plan. There have been some cases in privatizations where that has occurred, but this does not relate to a privatization. This is simply a terminated employee and the treatment that that individual is requesting. There are a few amendments for your consideration, and I drafted Amendment A2 as a way to give the Commission another way of approaching this issue, which does not require the commission to confront that precedent of allowing a terminated employee to continue in the plan. Basically, the A2 amendment would require a full actuarial service credit purchase. A justification that the commission might wish to consider for that one is that the commission might consider the bug school employment to be sufficiently public in nature to be considered for a full actuarial service credit purchase. Another reason for considering that amendment is that under the bill, the individual would be allowed to purchase any past service that the individual has already provided to that school. And with that service credit purchase, the individual would immediately have more than enough service credit, given the individual's age, to qualify for the rule of 90. The individual has indicated that he intends to retire upon hitting the rule of 90. And so the individual might retire immediately after the bill passes and after making the contributions. Given that situation, the commission may not wish to get into the precedent issues that are set if the individual really doesn't intend to remain in employment. So the A2 amendment is an alternative that the commission may wish to consider. Otherwise, the amendments are largely technical. The A3 amendment would leave the bill as it is, but would not allow the past service to be credited. This would force the individual to at least work a little bit longer before qualifying for the rule of 90. So with those comments, I carry
back. Mr. Bergstrom?
Mr. Chair, my name is Dave Bergstrom. I'm the director of the Minnesota State Retirement System. This proposal would set a precedent for probably hundreds, if not thousands, of employees who have terminated in the past and want service credit. It would not only apply to the Minnesota, the precedent would not only cover Minnesota State Retirement System, would cover all of the public pension plans in the state. In essence, you have a terminated employee who wants to receive service credit for credit that is not covered. Essentially, every terminated employee could make that same claim. The actuarial cost of this is about $40,000.
How much?
About $40,000. If you are going to approve this, Mr. Chair, my recommendation would be that you would require the full actuarial cost. And if you do nothing, Mr. Aitken actually qualifies for the rule of 90 in August of 2007. So he, right now, Mr. Chair, is deferring to the rule of 90, and we'll reach that in a little over a year.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Aitken, or Representative Moe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee. I appreciate you hearing this issue. This has been before you, as Senator Larson had said. Just a couple of details that I don't think have been brought up yet. Mr. Aitken was not terminated for any fault of his own. This particular office was closed. The decision was made by the Department of Education. Mr. Aitken then came to the Bugganegishing School, which is a Bureau of Indian Affairs school in between Bemidji and Deer River, to invest his time and energy in the community that greatly needed someone of his knowledge and experience. He's been a great asset to our community and to the education of the kids in our community. I think he was just shy, just over a year remaining before he reached the rule of 90. And I would ask the committee to acknowledge his commitment and service to not only education in Minnesota, but specifically the education needs of the Leech Lake Reservation, and honor his request for service of just over a year to reach the rule of 90. And I'd like to, I know Mr. Aitken has a couple things he'd like to add.
Mr. Aitken?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, members of the commission, my name is Joe Aitken. I'm a member of the Leech Lake Reservation. And yes, that's true. Quite honestly, I wouldn't be here if I had only 10 or 15 years of uninterrupted service with the Department of Education. but 28 years and 11 months, I think, merits discussion and perhaps review. So for practical purposes, I'll say 29 years, if you'll forgive me for those pushing on those 30 days. And in June, I will be 60 years of age, if you can believe that. I'm blessed, actually. After that office that Representative Moe mentioned, the Minnesota Indian Scholarship Program, a program that started in 1955 with $5,000 by two Republicans, mind you, from Beltrami County, and grew to just under $2 million under my 28 years of administration. We had, at the end of my tenure, between 100 and 120 Indian graduates from four-year degree schools every 12 months. That's unbelievable. There's probably not a greater disappointment in my lifetime to work for an organization for 29 years and have the rug pulled out from under you without a process to appeal to. My position as director of the Minnesota Indian Scholarship Program was abolished. It was abolished. You need to know that. It wasn't, you can go over here and work, you can go over here. They abolished a position, and I would have had to come down here and compete with the individuals, I'll be careful with my adjectives, that closed the office at a $39,000 a year job, I think. So I went from $69,500 after almost 20 years of employment down to $9,000 on unemployment. And it wasn't like I was sitting on my hands feeling sorry for myself. I interviewed and applied for many, many jobs in the area at the time.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman? Well, Mr. Chairman, just some follow-up comments. And I've known Joe since, about 1987 when he headed up the scholarship program up at Bemidji. And back in those days, we had a subcommittee in the Senate dealing with Indian education. So we spent a lot of time at the various reservations around the state looking at scholarship programs. And, I think it was Governor Ventura and the Department of Education pulled the rug from underneath this really outstanding program, Joe suffered the consequences of not even being able to transfer to another job. So he has a story to tell, and it's unfortunate that the Indian children, I think, in the state of Minnesota have suffered because of Joe's absence in that position. So that's why we're before you today with his request.
I mean, doesn't the bill, what has changed from last year when we turned this down? I mean, the bill basically just speeds up eligibility for Rule of 90.
That's right. Mm-hmm.
So I'm not quite sure.
Mr. Chairman, my understanding is that it did pass this commission and 2 years ago.
It was not in the House.
No, it came in the House.
Okay.
Think so.
It was. I'm sorry. Excuse me. It was passed by the full floor of the House and the Senate, but not through this commission. Correct.
Well, if it passed the full House and Senate floors, why isn't it law?
Maybe Senator Larson.
We had included it in our bill, Mr. Chairman, as I recall, and the House did not pick it up. Is that right?
I don't think.
I don't
remember.
Right?
I don't recall.
I thought it was.
Right, yeah. Ed, do you remember?
Let's take it here.
Mr. Chairman, on page 2 of my memo, there's a paragraph there on past commission action, and it looks like in 2004 it was added to the Senate bill in Senate Finance, but the commission did not recommend it to pass.
Sir Larson, you sit on Senate Finance.
Yeah. Well, that might be one of the many amendments we put on in Senate Finance.
Mr. Chairman, I just want to reiterate this is just over a year of service commitment, Mr. Aiken is asking for this commission to honor. He has been a dedicated member of the education community in our district, serving that very same community that he had served almost for 29 years as a director of the Indian Scholarship Office. Again, I'd ask you to support his humble request.
Yeah, but not
$40,000 humble request. Mr. Aiken, you're currently working, right, up at the Buck School?
I'm narrowing the third year of my years at Bugnegishik School, yes.
So aren't you going to work through till August 07?
I approach this, Mr. Chair. If I should retire, we'd be creating a $50,000 position on the Leech Lake Reservation. Well, if assuming they have the same credentials I do, and that's a big piece of employment for our area. That may not sound big to any high rollers in here, but.
Wouldn't the community lose the experience that you have?
Well, at age 60 in a couple months and 29 years in the department and 3 years at Bugnegishik School, that adds up to just about 60 or rule of 92. But I don't want any more than I need to hit rule of 90.
I can assure the senator, too, that we will keep Mr. Aiken very involved in our community regardless.
Well, what do you want to do, Senator Larson?
I'd like to...
Senator Larson moves House File, Senate File 375, House File 446. You want to put the technical amendment on it, probably. How about full actuarial value? Apparently 40,000.
Mr. Chair, the full actuarial value is 40,000, and I would again reemphasize the precedent this would set. I'm not diminishing Mr. Aiken's value to the community, but we had hundreds of other state employees who were laid off as well, and did a very nice job for the state.
Okay, so Larson moves the bill with the A1 amendment on it. I'm a Representative Moe and Senator Larson. I'm personally not going to be able to support this. I don't know if the votes will be here or not, but I am concerned about the precedential nature of this. And it is no reflection of Mr. Aiken's service. It's
Mr. Chair, members of the Commission, if I may, on October 1st of 04, I asked Julie Bartz of the Teachers Retirement Commission to answer me a question. Is there a possibility that other employees can come to you as the same request as I have? And she said, absolutely not. She said, the Bugnegishik School is a non-public type 31 under District 115, which is Cass Lake, and this school does not meet the guidelines of a contribution to the teacher retirement. So precedent will never be established. An individual will have to be as goofy as me to try to go through this process to convince you. And I've got a copy of this letter.
A copy of that letter is being passed out for you now.
It is. Okay. So I don't understand the precedent. I don't agree with that, humbly and respectfully.
Julie works for you.
Mr. Chair, no, Ms. Bartz works for the Teachers Retirement Association.
Oh, TRA.
And quite frankly, Mr. Chair, that is my point, is that this position is not eligible for TRA coverage. It would not be eligible for PERA coverage, and therefore we are granting service credit to a position that would be ineligible. Again, if you're going to do this, the full actuarial value would seem to fit the Pension Commission's past practice, if indeed you decide to do this.
Mr. Thompson? Ms. Bartz works for your fund.
Mr. Chairman, Ms. Bart used to work for PERA, too, so she's got a long history. The only Native American school, or tribal school we cover is Red Lake, so he is not in a covered position. The school is not covered by TRA. And I can't speak. I don't know what Ms. Bart's really told him.
Very.
But Red Lake is the only school district that's covered by TRA. Mr. Chairman, I've been shown this memo from Julie Bartz, and what it does say, the school does not meet the guidelines to contribute to TRA. It's a non-covered school.
Representative Murphy.
Mr. Chair, I have a question, Mr. Bergstrom. Mr. Bergstrom, for the 29 years... Six months. That's how long Mr. Atkins worked?
Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy, we have 28 years and 11 months of service credit.
28 years and 11 months. And so if he retired now, he would have a penalty. Is that my understanding?
Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy, that is correct.
Okay. And if somehow he gets up to gets the other 2 years in, or a year and a half in.
Year and a month.
2 years, yeah. Or he gets older. then he would not have the penalty, right?
Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy, if he left his money in without any change whatsoever, he would qualify for the rule of 90 just before August of 2007, end of July 2007. That's under current law with no change.
Whether he was working or not?
Mr. Chair, Representative Murray, that's correct.
Okay.
Just by leaving his money in.
And Mr. Chair, Mr. Atkins, why don't you want to do that?
Let me, if I may, back up just a second, and I know your time is important.
You should ask her, answer her question.
Why don't I want to do the, just wait out my time?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And, well, I don't know how many of you individuals had a father that worked for one organization for 29 years and got dumped on, for lack of a better term. I don't think that's Minnesota nice. I don't think that's fair. And if I could best use my time for the 2 years to hit rule of 90, I could have seeked out a job as a janitor in a courthouse, which would have allowed me to contribute to PERA, to P-E-R-A, I believe. But why wouldn't I teach driver's ed in the classroom, driver's ed behind the wheel, teach a golf class for needy Indian kids who need a role model as a Leech Laker, which I am, in a Leech Lake school on the Leech Lake Indian Reservation. To me, my time was better served society and the Indian community by teaching in a classroom setting and working with these 300 kids, K through 12, but we only have 77 in the high school. And if money's an issue, let me say one more. I want to go down swinging here, Mr. Chairman, if I may. In 1995, the Minnesota Department of Education received the largest gift ever, $1 million, by Ethel Curry, a lady who lived to be 106 years of age in Rochester, Minnesota. It was in the newspaper. Perhaps some of you remember it. I was pretty proud of that. She gave it to the Minnesota Indian Scholarship Program because she, quote, like the results of the program and the work that we did. A $1 million gift. Now, you're talking $40,000? I lost almost a $70,000 a year job and went to $9,000. With humility and inability to get a job interview in an area, because times were tough, if you remember, back in 02. I'm not proud of that. And I'm not... I don't want to be here. I wish I could have worked my rule of 90 with the Department of Education. That was beyond my control. I'm a veteran of the United States Army Reserve. I'm an American Indian working, trying to improve the lives and the hopelessness of some of our American Indians. Now, all of you know Indian education is an area we need help and work on. Give that some thought before you vote.
Okay.
I'm sorry about my motion.
Here we have the Larson motion before us. It's the bill with the A1 technical amendment. Discussion. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed?
No.
I don't believe the motion's adopted. So will not be included. You want a division? You want a division? Division. All in favor of incorporation, raise your hand. All opposed? It's not incorporated. Takes three votes on each side.
Appreciate your time anyway.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Representative Moe. Okay, let's go, Representative Thiessen. Or wait, it's Osment's bill. Representative Osment. Mm-hmm. Minneapolis teachers. Representative Osment, or
Mr. Chair and members, this bill is one that has a proposal for providing for a merger between the Minneapolis teachers and TRA, and I'd like for Thomas to explain the bill.
Mr. Thompson.
Luther Thompson, representing TRA. I think you've all
been... Did Ms. Bartz work on this proposal?
No, but if you call the phone center, she'll probably give you her opinion, I'm sure. In all sincerity, she does good work. She's a very conscientious employee. She's very...
We're not picking on her.
If you got a problem, she'll solve it, that's for sure.
Okay.
Or create a new one. What I'd like to go through here, I handed out two things. One is there's three pages of a lot of numbers. I'm not going to go into it in much detail, but I wanted to give you some perspective as to where we are now versus where we were before. And then there's another page that's a summary. And I guess I'll go through the summary first, and then I can go through some of these numbers to give you a perspective of what happened from 2005 to 2006 here in terms of the because it was delayed, the increasing cost. This bill does provide for a total merger of the Minneapolis Teacher Fund into TRA. We accomplished the funding of this by extending the full funding for TRA out to a 30-year amortization period, and that would be out to 2037. It also requires that all existing statutory special supplemental contributions that are currently going to Minneapolis will continue to be paid to TRA. This is approximately $21 million from the state that was legislated in 93, 96, and 97. It also mandates a local contribution of $2,250,000 each from the city of Minneapolis and the special school district continuum. There's also a mandated employer supplemental contribution of 3.64% that continues to be paid to TRA. This was in 1992 legislation. Employer and employee contributions are going to be increased by 0.5%. The employer increase in the current legislation is deferred to the next biennium to lessen the impact. However, this increase is required to keep TRA fully funded and not create a deficiency. So it's expected and would be mandatory that an appropriation be made to pay this. Otherwise, TRA would experience a deficiency of about 0.5%. And if we're going to be fair about this, TRA didn't create the problem, but we're here to help you try and solve the problem. There's a 0.2 of an increase in the formula multiplier of 1.7 to 1.9. This is for coordinated members only, and it's only for prospective teaching service. That means after July 1, 2006. I mean, this is a modest enhancement. In order to achieve the full benefits of this, for example, you'd have to a new teacher would have to be hired after July 1 of this year, teach for 40 years, and would receive a 12% increase in his or her retirement benefit. A current teacher with 35 years of service, if they taught five more years, would receive a 1.2% increase approximately. That amounts to, if your high five is $50,000, that would amount to about a $500 increase in your retirement benefit, and you would have paid in about $1,200 additional in contributions. The other point that needs to be made about this is that this mitigates the impact on Minnesota taxpayers and teachers by taking legislative action at this time. You'll recall a year ago we had a bill up here asking for a 3/10 of an increase. The cost to Minneapolis went up by $120 million, as referenced in their actuarial study. That's the equivalent of $11 million a year for the next 30 years in additional costs by waiting 1 year. We fully expect if we waited one more year, there's no reason to believe that, you know, a further negative impact of that nature, you know, would occur. I think our major goals were try to protect and secure the retirement benefits for the existing retirees in Minneapolis, and this bill does that. They'll all be transferred to the post-retirement fund that currently exists for TRA members. They will receive the same increases in the future that TRA members increase get at the present. When we look at the impact in terms of the formula increase, you also have to look at that for current teachers hired after 89, they don't have the rule of 90. And so this 2% in no way compensates, you know, for the rule of 90. It's a very modest increase. We think it's workable, passable, and fiscally responsible. We think it's exceptionally good. If you try to take a long-term view of public education and not just look at, you know, the two-year budget cycle or even getting beyond the issue of retirement policy, future teachers are going to, you know, right now under the rule of 90, we have teachers retiring at 57 with 33 years of service. Teachers hired after 89 will be expected to work to 66 with 40-some years of service. If you expect, you know, if you think public education is going to be facing a crisis in the next few years, what do you expect from these teachers 35, 40 years from now, or who will be teaching them? This proposal retains some current teachers. It'll help recruit others, and it'll reward those for long and faithful service to public education. A couple of points. If you go to the last, what's called Exhibit 3 on the three-page handout, this was the handout that TRA explained a year ago and what the Senate bill was based upon. I'd like to point out three things on here. At that point, there was what we call a supplemental or a tail of about 0.26% deficiency after the merger and formula increase, and that was to be paid for, you know, a third, Minneapolis, the school district, and the state. That no longer exists under the current plan. When we talked about this a year ago, it was a $1.1 billion deficit in Minneapolis. That's gone up by $120 million. Now, part of that deficit was paid for by the $20 million they were getting from the state, the additional Minneapolis supplemental, and the additional school district employer contribution. You'll also notice at the bottom of the page there, in that yellow box in 1996 legislation, they were receiving $3,015,000 from the state. In the past year, they lost $1 million of that because of the 96 statute that required that they meet certain standards in terms of meeting a hypothetical portfolio. Well, they're paying, you know, they're selling off assets to pay retirement benefits. It's virtually impossible for them, you know, to continue in this direction. But that $1 million would come back to TRA based upon our performance. The second page, Exhibit 2 there, simply points out what the Senate bill may have looked like. We would have had a tail now. Instead of 0.26, it would have been 0.59. That's 59 hundredths of a percent. The increase from 0.26 to 0.59 is approximately $12 million. That's the additional cost of waiting 1 year, $12 million a year for the next 30 years. You'll also notice that TRA did, we were virtually 100% funded a year ago. We had $1 million excess. We now have $268 million in a deficit. That was due to, we had to recognize a deferred actuarial liability of about $500 million. Next year, that deferred, we'll have a deferred gain of about $50 million. So that also reduced our sufficiency by about 0.4 of a percent.
Where's that 268? You have to do a division.
268 would be in the first column there. Item
there line, it is. I see it.
Line
yes.
Five.
Number five, yes. Okay.
We then go to Exhibit 1, and this is the basis of the bill today. This is with a 2% multiplier. Amortizing over 30 years. If we defer the employer contribution for 1 year and you make appropriations in the next biennium, which we're expecting, that then this would go to 2037, we'd be fully funded. If you look at the one, two, three, the fourth column from the right, it shows down there at the bottom line sufficiency, deficiency. The end result of all of this is a negative 0.03 of a percent deficiency to the fund. That's the equivalent of about $1 million. It's virtually, it's negligible. Moreover, when you look at the down there at that yellow box, it shows in the second line, the 96 legislation is only providing $2 million because of the investment performance over the last 5 years. That will increase to $3,015,000, which will turn that negative into a plus. But again, plus or minus 0.03 is negligible. So virtually this results in a fully funded TRA with the merger with a 0.2 of an increase. But the, you know, the risk is to TRA. We're assuming that the appropriation for the 0.5% employer is going to be forthcoming, and we expected that would go through the school aids formula. But with that, take any questions, and if there were any other discussion about amendments or whatever.
Mr. Chair and members, I'd like to say that this has taken a very difficult situation and I think has turned it into a win for the Minneapolis Teachers Retirement Fund, the TRA, as well as the taxpayer of the state of Minnesota.
And the 0.2 increase brings, where does that bring the benefit relative to other states?
It'll bring us up to probably the bottom third. You know, we haven't, we certainly would certainly, I mean, our goal is still the 0.3, but we'd be in the middle third of those and actually at the, you know, the bottom of the middle third. So it's a modest increase.
Top of the bottom third and the,
it'd be the
bottom of the
bottom
middle,
of the middle third.
Bottom of the middle third.
Okay.
Yep.
It could be that's right above the top of the lower third.
Senator, question. Senator Larson.
Luther, you have a resolution from the TRA board on this?
Yes, the TRA board does support it. The board president is here today. If you'd like to hear it from him directly, this is essentially identical to what we proposed a year ago. Except
with certain changes.
With certain changes. We reduced the contribution by a tenth. That deferred actuarial liability that we recognized, I mean, we fully expect that to disappear. That's one of the short-term fluctuations in our funding from year to year. We expect it to go up and down.
When does the property tax increase?
Mr. Chairman, how about the School Boards Association? Do you have a resolution from them?
I do not have a resolution from them.
Do you know what the cost is going to be to the various school districts?
Yes, a 0.5% increase will be approximately $18 million a year. 0.5% is based upon the current, the payroll of $3.6 billion in the state of Minnesota.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
I mean, and I guess the main point I'd like to make about that is that we've been fortunate to keep the contribution rates relatively low because we've been paying for this up front and we're fully funded. And You know, the nice thing about being fully funded, everybody wants to take credit for it. And if you're poorly funded, everybody wants to shift the responsibility to somebody else. But we think this is reasonable and workable. And
Mr. Chairman, are we also going to take over the investments for the Minneapolis teachers?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Larson, all of the investments that remain in Minneapolis will be going to the State Board of Investment as of July 1st of this year, and they will be managed by Mr. Howard Bicker.
Yes, I understand that. And Mr. Chairman, what kind of assets do they have in their fund right now?
It's about
Mr. Chairman, if I may, Karen Kilberg, Minneapolis Teachers Retirement Fund. At the end of the year, we had approximately $750 million in assets.
Okay. Okay. Mr. Bicker, have any comments on his great investment portfolio and what we can expect out of him?
Mr. Bicker, are you with us? Why don't you put the shrug on the tape? You must have a boilerplate 30 seconds on this.
Mr. Chairman and members, I'm Howard Bicker, Director of the State Investment Board. Those assets would be commingled with all of our other assets, so it would be invested identical to TRA, PRA, and MSRs.
Mr. Chairman, do you have your returns for 05 yet? What did you do?
Mr. Chairman, for and Senator Larson, for calendar 05, we made 10%. I think it was 9.9.
Okay, apparently there's two technical amendments. Ms. Kilberg, stick with us here. Yeah, pass them both out.
Well, I don't know.
Members, while the two amendments are being passed out, I will try and explain them. The A1 amendment was suggested by Murph. In the bill, there is a rededication of some MRF aid if there ever comes a time where MRF requirements will be less than what the state appropriation is for MRF. That amount, reflecting the current budget, is set at slightly over $8 million. The upcoming forecast suggests that the state contribution to MRF will grow to $9 million, and this sets the rededication at what is anticipated to be the correct amount for the future, rather than the current amount for the last year of the biennium.
Osmond moves the A1. Discussion. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed. Motion adopted.
The A2 amendment is a correction of two references, one a date reference and the other a reference to the State Board of Investment, that Mr. Thompson pointed out that when the bill was drafted, these were incorrect and needed to be modified.
Osmond moves the A2. Discussion. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed. Motion adopted. Questions? Further questions? Does anybody in the audience want to testify?
No.
Ms. Allswager? Ms. Kilberg, did you have anything to add right now?
Mr. Chairman, thank you. I would just like to encourage everyone to vote for this bill. It's been a matter of discussion for years and years and years. I think from what Luther has said that you can see that the problem is just getting worse. We have our retirees are very worried. Our active members are leaving Minneapolis to go elsewhere because they're also concerned. You've literally, by not addressing this problem, or I should say we literally, by not addressing this problem, have put everybody's lives that are retired on hold. And so I would encourage you to adopt this.
Okay. Ms. Allswiger.
Mr. Chair, members of the Commission, Jan Allswiger, Education Minnesota. Education Minnesota has a couple of goals here when we look at the, or criteria, I should say, in terms of looking at the possible fixes for Minneapolis. First of all, we want to make sure that we protect the interest of all of our members, and that includes TRA, Minneapolis, St. Paul, and Duluth teachers. We want to make sure that pension benefits are secure now and in the future, and we know that we must fix the Minneapolis pension deficit as soon as possible because, frankly, if we don't, we're putting the other pension plans at risk in the future. There was a bill floating around earlier, or the idea of a bill floating around earlier, that this was a that there would be a bailout of Minneapolis by TRA. I want to make it very clear. This is not that bill. Education Minnesota would not support a bill such as that. This is a reasonable approach, a responsible approach that is, first of all, proposed by TRA, supported by Education Minnesota and the Minneapolis teachers. It is a win-win situation. Not only do you fix Minneapolis, but you provide a small benefit increase to these teachers. And for those of you who asked where are we in the rank of formula multiplier, there are 34 states that you can compare teacher pension plans to because they're coordinated with Social Security. Our teachers who have the rule of 90 are number 33 out of 34 in that ranking of formula multiplier. For those teachers who do not have the rule of 90, we are number 28 out of 34. It's time to fix this Minneapolis pension benefit and also to improve benefits for our members. Thank you. I'll be happy to answer any questions you might have.
Representative Wardlow.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's comforting for me to know that Ed Minnesota's on board, because last time I talked to Ms. Allswiger, they weren't real happy with the bill, but I probably would have voted for it anyway, just to let you know, because you've got some Minneapolis teachers sitting out here that their life is hanging in the balance as far as pension goes. And it's, I don't care who made the mistake or the problem. I don't know how this problem got to be so bad. Everybody's pointing fingers to everybody, but it's time we just step up the plate and take care of it. And it's just going to get more and more expensive as time goes on.
Representative Allswiger.
Mr. Chair, Representative Wardlow, yes, there was that idea of a bill that we did not support at all, and that's the one that I did have a conversation with you about. This bill does not even resemble that bill that was out there previously.
Okay, other questions? Thank you. Okay, welcome.
Senator Pogemiller, members of the commission, I'm Dick Rainville, and I'm president of Education Minnesota Osseo, a very large local in the northwest corner, and 1,600 members, all covered by TRA, and I am a product of the Minneapolis schools, and I would certainly like to thank the Minneapolis teachers for doing such an excellent job of preparing me for a wonderful career in education. And our members were somewhat puzzled by this proposal, but once they understand that if we're going to have any pension improvement whatsoever, first and foremost, we have to fix the Minneapolis plan, and certainly if we do that, they can look to a quality benefit package as they look for retirement. So as a district that is a player in this, certainly our members support it when they understand it. And I think this is good public policy. I think this is the good direction to go. We solve a problem that, as Representative Wardlow says, has a lot of people to blame, but this is the right thing to do, and I encourage you to support it.
Thank you, Mr. Rainville.
Thank you.
Appreciate it.
Mr. Chair, members, Jim Grathwall, Minneapolis Schools. We support the bill, perhaps not surprisingly. I don't think this guarantees you membership inclusion in Profiles Encourage, but I think virtue is its own reward, and this is one where You're doing the right thing by voting for the bill. I'd like to thank the author of the bill, TRA, others who worked on the bill. Our concern is whether or not, without this bill, we'll be able to recruit and retain teachers without the promise of a pension fund. At a certain point, our staff begin to notice whether or not, when the fund reports keep coming out, whether or not they believe they can trust there'll be a fund for them. So, again, this helps teachers in Minneapolis, teachers and retirees spread across the state, and I think protects kind of the notion that in public employment, one of the benefits you'll receive is a public pension. Thanks very much.
Questions?
Sure.
Okay, thank you. Ms. Schwab?
Mr. Chairman and members, Grace Schwab with the Minnesota School Boards Association. The School Boards Association understands the issues Minneapolis Pension Plan has been having, and we sympathize with them greatly, but we have some really strong concerns with this bill. The first being, is the biennial money going to be available for school districts in the coming future? It seems to be a battle every year here, and there is not enough assurance in HESS that those dollars are going to be there to be covered. The other is, unlike cities and counties, as you all well know, we can't increase our levies to support pension increases. So those are dollars that have to come out of our general operating money. And $17, for instance, would have been what you gave, close to what you gave early childhood, close to what you gave gifted and talented programs last year as a comparison. So we hope you'd consider those items as you go forward.
Okay, questions? And as the bill is structured, Representative Osmond, that's a concern for the next biennium, not this one.
That's correct.
Which is different from the way the Senate bill that passed was
that's
drafted.
Correct. That's my understanding.
So,
thank you.
So, Mr. Chair.
For the increased school employer share, it's 07.
And Mr. Chair, Ms. Schwab, what per pupil amount is that then?
Did you say $17 per pupil?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Murphy, we usually use $1 costs $1 million. So if you wanted to add a dollar to the general education formula, it would cost you $1 million.
But for this to be, for the school district's contribution for this particular bill, that would need to have how much each year for the school district's contribution per pupil?
Mr. Martin?
Members, the TRA payroll is in the neighborhood of $3 billion. The contribution increase is 0.5%. So 0.5% of $3 billion is about $15-16 million.
How much?
15 or $16 million.
Per year?
Per year, and increasing over time.
Mr. Thompson, that's the calculation you're working with?
Yes, it's a 0.5% of the, you know, the $3.6 billion comes out to. I don't know how many pupils there are, but you take $18 billion, and if you have the number for the pupils, you divide them in there.
So it's 16. It's 18 15
million,
to 17.
18 million divided by the number of pupils.
16. The number I've heard is 17. So
million.
It's 15 to 17. Yeah.
But per pupil.
Oh.
Is my question.
It's about 800,000 students, roughly, isn't it?
$17. You told us to turn off our electronic. I mean, I could.
Mr. Osmond.
Mr. Chair, I'm told it's $15 per pupil.
Yeah.
$20. $20 per pupil. Thank you very much.
We think it's closer to 15.
Yeah, we think it's closer to 15.
Somewhere between 15 and 20.
Mr. Chair, I think
I like his answer better.
I think it makes a difference whether you're talking pupils or pupil units. I think pupil units, maybe you're talking 15 and pupils units.
We can get that calculation now. We'll get that calculation. Okay, thank you, Ms. Schwab. Appreciate it. Anybody else want to test? Representative Murphy? Anybody else want to testify and then Representative Murphy? Are you coming? Do you want to wait?
Mary? Sure.
Okay.
He might answer.
Uh,
Mr. Chairman and members, again, my name is Howard Bicker. I'm Director of the State Investment Board. I have a technical question on page 10, lines 1028 through 1031. When I read this language, it appears to me as though we're probably setting up potentially another pre-69ers, because it says their benefits shouldn't be impaired, and Minneapolis Teachers has a formula right now, and the state has a formula right now, and at some future date, somebody could go back and look at Minneapolis's formula versus the state's formula, and things could change 20 years from now, and you'd all have a pre-69 situation. My concern is that the state board is responsible for the calculation of the post-retirement benefit increase. We would probably have to keep track of some other formula. It would be just my suggestion that those four lines go away.
Mr. Chairman, if I may, what this does is it sets up for another section in the bill that says that the Minneapolis teachers' basic members will have their benefits calculated under the current articles of incorporation. As you know, they have a different retirement age, and that would allow them to continue. We have less than 200 active basic members, and it would allow them to continue to have their annuity calculation calculated just as the same as all of the other basic members have. And I also think there's another section in the bill that does eliminate our post-retirement adjustment and says that all of our members will receive the same post-retirement adjustment as TRA. So we're just talking about the annuity calculation of the active basic members, and I would be opposed to eliminating this section.
It refers back to page 7 language, lines 719 through 727. Questions? Thank you, Mr. Bicker. Thank you, Mr. Bicker. Did you want to add anything?
No, that's fine, Mr. Chairman. One of my claims to fame is I'm not a lawyer. So.
A plus, right?
So, Mr. what does Mr. Martin say about that?
Mr. Martin.
Members, this is fairly broad language on page 10, lines 28 through 31. I think the point that Mr. Bicker is making is that it's subject to a number of possible interpretations. If the intent is really to replicate or to do what essentially is being done on page 7, I'm not sure that we need to do it both specifically and broadly to do the same thing. So I'm not sure what 10.28 and thereafter really adds other than potential confusion or potential problems.
Ms. Kilbert?
Mr. Chairman, I just want to make sure that there isn't room for a lot of interpretation, and I think that this language states explicitly that these people will not have, because of some other interpretation, their benefits reduced. And in combination, the language in combination, I think, makes it much clearer than if you took out the language on page 10.
You know, it just... I'm not a lawyer either, but as I look at the language, 28 to 31, it says you cannot impair or diminish at the time, and this clock is at the time of the existence of this consolidation. So once a consolidation takes place, that's the moment in time. So I don't, if this provides some comfort, seems to me it's pretty clear. We should probably keep looking at it, but... Okay, anybody else want to testify?
Mr. Chairman, I just wanted to reiterate 2 points. The one being is that, you know, it's absolutely essential to get that money in the next biennium, and that's the risk TRA is taking with this. It's we're trusting the legislature to do the right thing in the next biennium. Regarding this language, you know, that's an issue we have. As far as the post-retirement fund, all current retirees in Minneapolis will come under the post-retirement fund, the TRA, and as was pointed out earlier, for the basic members, there is language on there that explicitly protects that. And I think it's whether or not there's other benefits there, I'm not sure what they would be, but if we think the post-retirement increases were protected, were transferred over to our statute, and also for the basic members, they're protected. That's all I have. But we need the 0.5% in the next biennium. Otherwise, we will be here every year for the next 30 years, and we don't want to become, I hasten to use, we don't want to become the next Minneapolis, is what I mean. So we do expect to be fully funded.
Okay, thank you. Senator Larson?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I'd like to hear from the pre-69ers, too, because if we're going to be benevolent today, we might as well be a little more benevolent. And, Rick, I'd like to have you come up and just explain our proposal and remind the folks about the predicament that the legislature got the pre-69ers in by some action they took some years ago.
Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the Commission. My name is Rick Winters. I'm a pre-69 teacher. I'll let my colleague introduce himself as well.
I'm Tom Selwold, retired from Bloomington, pre-69 member.
We've spoken with every member of the Commission regarding the pre-69 teacher issue, and essentially what it is that a class of teachers was defined by the legislature back in 1968, and that class of teachers was given 5 options to choose for a pension retirement. Over the course of time, those options that were given were taken away by the legislature from that defined class of teachers. But within that group, a subset of that class was given 2 pension choices at retirement. The rest of them were only given 1. And what we've tried to do is address that inequity through various means. Last year, there was a provision in the bill that passed the Senate that addressed the issue. It did not pass or get attention in the House. We've had preliminary discussions with members of the Commission, some members of the Commission, about ways of addressing that this time. And if there's going to be a consolidation of TRA Minneapolis, we would certainly like to get this issue resolved at the same time and hopefully in the same manner. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, members of the Commission, the issue that I'm sure it's very clear to all of you, but for the others who are here, over time, almost immediately or within a couple of years after all of us made our choice, in other words, we selected one of the 5 options, systematically those 5 options were closed out and eventually all got rolled into the high 5.
I agree.
Objection is that the first group that got closed out and rolled into the high 5 average were essentially given the option in the legislation of either accepting that move into the high 5 at their time of retirement, or if their original choice was more beneficial to them, they could revert back to their original choice. Our objection has always been that those of us who were in one of the other 4 choices were not given that same option as the successive articles of legislation rolled us out of our original choice and into the high 5. We're sure that none of this was done with any ill intent. Everybody, I'm sure, took this action with our best interest in heart. It just so happened that it did adversely affect some of us at our point of retirement when we were not given the option of having our original choice. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it. Representative Osment moves that 2847, as amended, be recommended by the Commission. It would not be in the first non-controversial bill. I don't believe. Don't you think we should have a second bill? Or I think so. I think so.
Mr. Chair.
There's going to be other items in a second bill. So, Representative Murphy.
Mr. Chair, going back to the consolidation bill in 2000 or 1996 or 1997, which was going to bring everybody up to full funding by 2020, does this changing for this large number of people to 2037 have any kind of negative impact on those other funds that are supposed to be, we were all geared for 2020. Does this have a negative thing at all?
Mr. Martin?
Members, the amortization date of one pension fund doesn't have necessarily anything to do with any other plan. We've already addressed this issue to some extent a couple of years ago when we extended the PERA amortization period beyond 2020. And just by a benefit increase under Chapter 356, we would kick the TRA amortization date out past 2020 just by operation of a standard mathematical process. So this is not without precedent, and I'm not sure it has any direct impact.
Okay. That makes me feel better, Mr. Chair. And then, Mr. Martin, will adoption of this bill then create an idea that no funds can have benefit increases until 2037?
I doubt it.
Representative Murphy, there's a benefit increase in this bill as part of the proposal.
Right.
I think we have varied from uniformity since 1997. It was an ideal but is not necessarily practiced. So if that's your notion, tying the uniformity, what it sets is a potential at some future date to, again, implement uniformity by extending this particular benefit improvement to other pension plans.
Okay. And then, Mr. Chair, Mr. Martin, is there going to be a good year in the future? Do you think that will... where we can talk about the positive impacts of the Rule of 90 and that we should adopt the Rule of 90 for public employees hired after 1989?
I don't know if Mr. Martin can answer that. That's more of a rhetorical question.
That would be a good question for somebody to answer because we're going to have big problems without it. And I thought that was brought out, and we shouldn't forget about it.
Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Senator Larson.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, we've dealt with the Minneapolis fund now, purportedly, but what about St. Paul and Duluth? Now, Duluth has dropped about 13% in their funding ratio in the year, and St. Paul has dropped... they're about 70% right now. So what are our plans for getting those folks on board or doing something about them?
That potentially could be discussion for the future, I think. They've asked not to be part of this year's discussion.
But we're still going to allow them to invest their own funds?
At this stage, yes. Okay, we have the Osment motion. Let me just ask before the vote, how many people are here to on this bill? Just raise your hand, Minneapolis teachers or others. Okay, thank you very much for your patience and for taking the time. On the Osment motion, all in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
All opposed? Motion's adopted. Sounds unanimous. Thank you very much, Representative. I think The Senate has passed a bill. We're hoping the House can pass this bill. And then obviously we have to work with the executive branch. So it's not over yet. There have been, just so you know, there have been discussions with the executive branch. And they're aware of what's going on. The state auditor is also involved in the discussions. So thank you very much. Okay, let's try to do two others here today. We have to be out of the room, but for the technical bill, let's do number 8, Senator Pappas's bill. I think that's pretty good to go. You have a, Representative Thiessen, you have an amendment to number 8. This is the reporting requirements, authorized investment provisions. It's in the packet under number 8. Nope, here it comes.
Be handed out right now.
Please keep it down to your outside, please. Okay, who's speaking on this?
I'll start out, Mr. Chairman.
Okay.
Okay, I'll be quick. Mr. Okay. Chairman, Representative Thiessen and I are proposing this legislation to clean up investment law and eliminate some redundant paperwork. The goals are to give greater flexibility to the pension boards in pursuing better investment returns by expanding the limit on other assets in statute to permit larger allocations to higher return opportunities, to move core equity commingled real estate investments out of the other assets group, in law, and to resolve an issue raised by the state auditor regarding commingled fund investments generally. There also is a goal to simplify life for pension fund administrators and boards, to reduce paperwork, to eliminate unnecessary and duplicative reporting requirements, to provide the information that policymakers will use but eliminate reports that are collected and then collect dust. Mr. Chairman, it's mostly a technical bill, make life a little easier for our pension boards. And Mr. Phil Kapler from the St. Paul Teachers Retirement Fund Association is here, and he's the one who's been taking the lead on proposing this legislation.
So this is, Mr. Kapler, this is a result of discussions with the auditor and with the Pension Commission staff?
Mr. Chairman, members, yes. And first off, I want to thank Mr. Burek and the folks over at the auditor's office who helped immeasurably to help refine and tool up the language to have the effects that we're looking for, and to eliminate some of the technical difficulties that were sort of lingering in the initial draft of the bill. We think it's a good proposal, pretty much as drafted. And the A-10 amendment, actually, I think we're very comfortable and would urge adoption of the A-10 and A-12 amendments.
Okay, I think, is the auditor's office here? Do you want to make a comment quickly? So these four pages are the total of the suggestion. There's nothing else. Okay.
Mr. Chairman, Carla Heil, Deputy State Auditor. Mr. Kapler is correct that we agree with A-10, which is what we worked out with Mr. Burek. Mr. Burek has drafted A-11, A-12, and A-13 where there was some disagreement. For example, the auditor's office does not agree with A-12.
So is A-12 in the A-14?
Mr. Chairman, no.
Okay.
The A-14 amendment is in lieu of the A-11 amendment.
Okay. So have you seen the A-14?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, and we do. The state auditor's office does agree with A-14.
Okay. So it's A-10 plus the A-14? Is that what we're doing? Okay. Let's just find the A-10 here.
Mr. Chairman, we said that we were okay with A-10 and A-12.
Under number 8, you have the A-10 members. Okay, there's the A-10. Okay, so Thiessen moves the A-10 and the A-14. Mr. Kep.
Just a technical question, Mr. Chairman, and Mr. Buick can probably answer fairly quickly. On page 1 of the A-10 amendment, lines 14 and 15, I'm wondering if the effect of the language that we have here isn't to allow insurance company commingled accounts and separate accounts only for real estate investment trusts as opposed to core commingled equity pools, which would also be of interest to the fund for inclusion here.
Mr. Chairman, members, maybe there's room for some additional sandpapering there. The language that you're pointing out isn't under any particular asset class. When you look a little later on in the REIT language, though, that would seem to, that language back there, and that would be on page 4, lines 10 through 13, again mentions insurance company commingled accounts and separate accounts. So the language there, I'm assuming, would be some sort of real estate investment. The language on page 1, lines 14 and 15, I think could be read more globally.
Okay, so Thiessen moves the A-10 and A-14, and there perhaps during the House and Senate hearings be some sandpapering of that language on the A-10, page 1, lines 114 to 115.
Mr. Chairman, we don't have the A-14.
We all have it. You've all seen it, though, I guess.
Oh, wait a minute. Here it is.
They've got it.
All right, we got it.
Okay, on the Thiessen motion for incorporation, this will go in the first bill. Discussion, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
All
aye.
Opposed, motion adopted. Thank you very much for your hard work on this, Auditor's Office and Mr. Kepler. That's it, Senator Pappas, you're in.
Okay,
then last one for today. I apologize to others, but this is all we'll be able to do today. And it's going to be number 14, State Auditor, stick with us. Mr. Martin.
Members, what you have at number 14 is a set of proposals from the State Auditor's Office. The State Auditor's Office had a working group on volunteer fire issues for the second year, and this represents the work product of that working group. There will be a conversation briefly about one item, as I understand it, in the bill. What it does is it allows more editorial flexibility by the state auditor in putting together a compilation report of financial data relating to volunteer fire plans. It also clarifies the equivalent fire department equipment and personnel standards for the receipt and qualification for state fire aid. It adds a definition of volunteer firefighter to the volunteer fire pension laws. It authorizes an individual retirement account transfer for certain death and survivor benefits payable to volunteer firefighters, and it authorizes the payment by volunteer fire plans of death benefits to estates. The area that I understand has an issue is the second item having to do with the qualification for fire state aid and the role of the fire marshal. Specifically, if you turn to page 3 of the -015 amendment, this is the last several pages of your packet is the baseline document, the 015 document, and page 3 is where the issue arises, having to do with the functional equivalent of a form that otherwise is filed with the Department of Revenue, laying out specific provisions that a volunteer fire department has. There is the authority right now, somewhat garbled in 1969 law about the equivalent way of proving up that you have a functioning fire department. This is intended to clarify it. I believe the State Auditor's Office prefers to eliminate the Section 2 from the document. That would be the A-1 amendment. The A-2 amendment in your packets basically attempts to strip this provision down to make a technical cleanup, leaving the question of fully equivalency to be determined by a future legislature. I think Ms. Heil may have something to say.
Okay. This is who's the member who's been working on this mostly? Osmond, but he's not here. So Smith moves the 015 language with the A1 incorporated, which removes Section 2. The auditor would like that removed.
That's fine.
Stakeholders, is that, are you comfortable with that? Okay. And so if we do the A1 amendment, we don't need to talk about the A2. Okay? Any discussion of the bill, of the 015 with Section 2 removed, A1? That's the motion. Anybody want to testify? Okay, on the Smith motion, this would be incorporated in the first bill. Discussion, all in favor say aye.
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 All opposed, motion adopted. Good work, Auditor's Office. Members, the Senate is going to take up that first bill in its GovOps Committee, or whatever it's called now. It's got a different name, on Wednesday afternoon. So we're going to start to process it. That's the first bill, the hopefully non-controversial stuff. And then I will be in consultation with Representative Smith about what's left over, and we'll just try to keep members informed where we're at. We may need another meeting. There may be a couple issues here that we need to deal with yet. And members of the commission should let me know if there's something that has not been dealt with that you want dealt with. Just let me know. It looks like we'll probably need another meeting. So, okay. Thank you. Great work. It's been a long haul here. Really appreciate it. Meeting adjourned.